Are you a manager or a leader?
Of course, the premise of high-impact leadership is that leaders are those people who respond to the challenge, who take up the reins, and set the course, both for themselves and for their organizations.
Managers manage the present. Leaders focus on the future.
Use future orientation to motivate people. That means highly valuing what the future holds in store, believing that no matter how good things are now, they could always be better.
Managers perform tasks. Leaders seize opportunities.
Now, exploitation is negative when it's done to people. However, it's perfectly all right to exploit opportunities, because to exploit means to seize and take advantage of. You see, the high-impact leader teaches people to solve problems and then recognizes and helps people exploit the opportunities that exist in the workplace.
What are the differences between managers and leaders? Consider these. Managers have employees. Leaders win followers. Managers monitor people. Leaders inspire them. Managers enforce rules. Leaders promote values. It's no wonder that managers who make the most impact are the ones who perform as leaders. Welcome to Career Track's High Impact Leadership with Mark Sanborn. In this powerful, highly informative audio program, you'll learn how to be more than just a manager. You'll discover what leaders have that managers don't, and how to develop it. How to make quick, smart decisions, and how to make your visions crystal clear to your people. You'll also learn some deadly assumptions which managers make, and the realities leaders operate in. And finally, if you are not presently in a management position, you'll learn tips on ways to lead and move up in your organization. The author of High Impact Leadership, Mark Sanborn, is the voice for high impact leadership in the 90s. He's known as the high content speaker who motivates. He's presented leadership skills seminars to such companies as Bell Atlantic, Pepsi-Cola, and the Marriott Corporation. He challenges people to think and grow in their commitment to themselves and their organizations. Before we begin, here are a few tips and suggestions to get the most from this Career Track program. First, as you listen, have a pencil and pad handy. When you hear a point that is of particular interest or importance, stop the tape and jot it down. By the time you complete this program, you will have created your own action plan to become a high-impact leader. Second, listen to these tapes several times, at home, at the office, in your car. The more you listen, the more clear these ideas and concepts will become. What is the difference between leading and managing? On this side, you'll discover that to manage means to simply maintain the status quo. But to lead means to take people and organizations where they need to be. Here is Mark Sanborn as he presents key steps to building leadership in your organization.
Thank you. High impact leadership today is going to address the need for leadership in America and the world on two different levels. First, there are a number of social issues that we must deal with globally. John Gardner is a former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and also the founding chairperson of Common Cause. He writes and lectures a great deal on leadership. Gardner believes that we may be sleepwalking through a very dangerous period of our world's history. Let's look at some of the challenges that we face both domestically and abroad. First, there's the challenge of technology and information. You know, we double the amount of information in the world every 1.7 years. And technology, although it can leverage human competency, it also has the downside effect of being able to leverage human weakness. What about productivity? From 1858 until 1958, American productivity was increasing at 2% per year. From 1958 to 1973, productivity increased only 1.7% per year. And from 1973 until 1988, productivity increased at 1%, half of what it had been increasing at for the past century. then we've got problems and challenges with a changing workplace. Did you know that 88% of the workforce growth between now and the end of the century will come from women, blacks, and people of Asian and Hispanic origin? We now do business in a multi-ethnic workplace. One-third of all of our population growth in the United States is coming from immigration. We have fewer entry-level employees available to draw from as a labor pool, and we have changes in the structure of businesses, more people working outside the traditional office environment or working from their home. Compound that with some of the challenges that we face in education. According to the National Academy of Sciences, 3 out of every 4 high school students who graduate are ill-equipped with problem-solving skills that will make them a success in college or on the job. Did you know that across the country, 25% of all high school students drop out before graduation, and that in the inner city, that reaches 50%? Did you know that there are some 23 million illiterate Americans coming into the workforce that are already there? That will cost American business billions to remedy. Of course, that doesn't take into account that 65% of the American workforce is called intermediately literate, which means they have a reading level somewhere between the 5th and the 9th grade. Then there are some other social issues. Homelessness, for instance. Any given night of the year, over 600,000 Americans live on the streets or in shelters. 100,000 of those Americans are young people, children. And by the way, that figure doesn't include runaways. 14% of the American population lives below the poverty level. That's 35 million Americans. On top of that, we have other issues that are on the front pages of the newspaper every day, issues like child abuse and unwed mothers at the high school level and other youth issues and national and international health crises like AIDS. Compound that with the environmental issues that we face. You read about toxic waste and oil spills and the greenhouse effect. Startling statistic, we are now able to track that our output per acre in the world is decreasing due to the direct effects of acid rain and pollution. Not only do we have problems domestically, but keep in mind that we are now members of a global community, and we've got to start managing these global relationships. We have the Pacific Rim countries that are offering new levels of competition that we as Americans have never experienced before. Did you know that 100% of all of the high school students who graduate in Japan have had at least 6 years of English training? Did you know, though, that of the high school students who graduate in the United States, 0.02% have had more than 3 years of Japanese speech training? You see, the Pacific Rim countries are better prepared to do battle in a global marketplace that's very competitive. And of course, in 1992, the European Economic Community will be formed, the newest, most powerful buying and selling force in the world. The relationships that we maintain and build in the global community are going to be very important. But I said leadership was important on 2 levels, the first being social, but the second being personal. You know why leadership is important at a personal level? It's because you and I would like to feel that we have the ability to control, if not at least influence, our environment. I think most of us would like to be able to create our futures, if not shape them. I think all of us want to be able to positively impact the lives of the people that we live and work with. In other words, leadership is important at a personal level because it gives us a chance to find meaning in a material world. What is the challenge of leadership? What is the dilemma? I think the dilemma is that leadership is more easily observed than it is explained. It's more easily demonstrated than it is taught. I have a friend who's a guide in South America. He's a naturalist. And whenever I talk to him, I'm impressed with his vast amount of information about different species of birds and animals and their habits and their behaviors. But it dawned on me that the natural world is fairly predictable. The social world is very unpredictable. You see, people respond in a range of responses. Therefore, 2 of the most important characteristics of leaders in the 90s will be the ability to be flexible and to live with ambiguity and uncertainty. Because the playing field of leadership is a very uncertain, unpredictable playing field. Let's define what exactly leadership is. As I've done seminars for hundreds of audiences in North America and abroad, I've had a chance to ask the members of my audiences to define leadership. To this point, I have never had anyone define leadership as title or position. They've never defined leadership as awards, accomplishment, or net worth. Without exception, when people define leadership, they define it as the skills that the leader uses to achieve success with people. Here's my favorite personal definition of leadership. I believe that leadership is the ability to help people and organizations surpass themselves. I've got to be honest with you, I've got some friends that think being in business is boring. And they think the only thing more boring than being in business is to be a business speaker, somebody who talks about being in business. But you see, I think business is a metaphor for life. Think about this. If in the course of your career, you only influence, only impact 10 people, if as a result of your influence, you can help each of those 10 people become 10% better, you will have created an entire unit of human contribution. Most of you have already impacted more than 10 people already. If you impact 20 people, if you can help them become 10% better, that's 2 units of human contribution. You see, leadership is about making more from the most precious limited resource we have, and that's human potential. That's why leadership's exciting. Sometimes people confuse leadership with managing. They don't know that there's a difference, or if there is a difference, they think it's semantical. Now, I'll readily admit that there's some overlap between leading and managing people, but there is a critical difference. To find out the difference between the two requires that you go back to the root words of manage and lead. The Greek root word for manage means to handle. The root word for lead means to go. You see, management is primarily static. Leadership is very dynamic. Managers deal with people where they're at. Leaders take people to where they need to be. Managers sustain the performance of an organization. Leaders improve the performance of an organization. Managers focus on what is necessary, but leaders focus on what is possible. You see, when we talk about leadership today, I'm talking about becoming an agent for organizational change. And even though the context that we're talking about leadership in today is business, keep in mind that these principles are generic in any organization or group of people where you want to become a positive influence on them and on the organization. Let me give you the acid test of leadership. For those of you today who manage or supervise people, to find out if you're also a leader, ask yourself one simple question. If you were stripped of your title, if you did not have the ability to punish or reward the people you manage, could you still get results with them? Because you see, management is power over people. It's positional power. Leadership is power with people. And the good news is you don't need a title or a job description to be a high-impact leader in America today. What you need are a set of skills. Because managers are given employees, but leaders must earn followers. The 6 skills for high-impact leadership, for being more than a manager, begin with self-mastery. Self-mastery is maximizing personal potential. The 2nd skill of leadership is stewardship. Stewardship is the strategic use of resources. We'll talk about the only 3 resources that leaders have to create results with. The 3rd skill is visioning. Visioning is simply designing a blueprint for the future. The 4th skill is persuasive communication. Because after the leader has created a vision of the future, he or she must be able to articulate that vision and sell it to followers. The 5th skill is empowerment. I define empowerment as understanding, enabling, and encouraging people. And finally, 6, and perhaps the most overlooked aspect of leadership, is service. Service is fulfillment through contribution. What evidences do we have of leadership in the workplace today? I find there are 2 pieces of evidence for leadership. The 1st, if you ask followers and employees, are the behaviors of the leader. The 2nd are the results that the leader produces. Employees look to leaders for certain behaviors. Top management looks to leaders for results. But what I found is if we can develop those 6 behaviors that I've just defined of leadership, we can become high-impact leaders. That's what we're going to talk about in the next several minutes. Let's begin by looking at self-mastery. The 1st skill for high-impact leadership is the ability to maximize personal potential. The year is 1988, Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada. Pyram Zurbriggen is a Swiss skier who has just completed his 1st run in the combined slalom. He is so successful, he is so good, that the observers figure he is a shoo-in for the gold medal. All he has to do is successfully complete his 2nd run. On his 2nd run, as he's headed down the course, the commentator starts to notice that he's pushing the envelope, that he's taking some unnecessary risks. And before you know it, Zurbriggen is down on the course, shattering his hopes for a gold medal. And the rhetorical question that people ask afterwards were, Why did he push so hard? Why not cautiously and conservatively ski the course and take home the gold medal? Nobody could answer that. But several weeks later, I was skiing at Copper Mountain, and I had a chance to ride up on the lift with a ski instructor who knew Perm Zurbriggen personally, someone who had skied with him. And as we were talking about what happened at the Olympics, the ski instructor said, "I don't know for certain, but I have a pretty good suspicion I understand what happened that day." You see, Zurbriggen wasn't skiing to win the gold medal. He was skiing to set a personal record. He knew that he could win the gold medal and still not ski his best run. Perm Zurbriggen knew that there was something more important than achieving goals, and that is achieving your maximum potential. That's what self-mastery is. Self-mastery is achieving your own personal maximum potential. That's the first building block in high-impact leadership. There are seven components that allow us to achieve self-mastery. Let's talk about those seven components. First is what I call security of self. You know, maybe you've heard the old cliche, "I've struggled all my life to be somebody, now I am and it's not me." You see, the problem is that most of us try to develop ourselves around the standards that the world has for us rather than developing our own uniqueness. This past December, I had a chance to take an adventure travel trip to Ecuador, South America. I spent about a week in the Ecuadorian highlands, a week in the Galapagos Islands, and a week in a region known as the Amazonas, just north of the Amazon River in what is known as the Headwaters area. I lived for 6 or 7 days on the Agua Rico River with a group of Cofan Indians. There are only 800 Cofan Indians in the world, only 800 people that speak their language. The leader of this particular portion of our trip was an American with dual Ecuadorian citizenship named Randy Borman. And he had put together a small group of Cofan Indians to guide us down the Agua Rico and to help us camp in the rainforest. The Cofan Indian leader of the group's name was Mauricio. Mauricio was in his 50s. Nobody knew exactly how old he was because he had no birth certificate. He had raised 2 grown sons. He could not read. He could not write. He could speak Cofan fluently, but only limited Spanish. Despite our inability to communicate, Mauricio and I became good friends. After spending a week with him in the Amazonas region, we invited him to join us in the Galapagos Islands. He had only been out of the Amazon once, and that was to go to Quito, the biggest city in Ecuador, to buy parts for an engine. So Mauricio, in his cushma, which is a long shirt that goes down to the knees, and no shoes, a bandana around his neck, and a cap, went with us to the Galapagos Islands. We had to buy him a pair of shoes for the trip. But when we got to the Galapagos, you can imagine his amazement, because here was a person who had spent his entire life living on a river. And the first question that Mauricio asked our guide in Spanish was, "Is this a giant river?" You see, he had no concept, no context of what an ocean was. So in his frame of reference, it had to be a very, very big river. Well, throughout the course of the trip, we were both fascinated and entertained by Mauricio's perceptions and some of the things that he did. And it wasn't unusual for those of us on the trip, the English-speaking tourists, to talk about Mauricio. One night we were talking about him, and one of the women in our group said to our guide, "Isn't Mauricio nervous? I mean, he cannot understand English, but he can obviously understand his own name. And throughout the trip, he hears us talking about him, and he hears us mentioning his name. Doesn't that make him nervous?" And I'll never forget what the guide said. He said, "You need to understand that the Cofan Indian culture has such a high level of self-esteem. They are so secure in themselves that it doesn't bother them in the least what you might be saying about them." You see, the first step to self-mastery is to take a lesson from Mauricio and to be so secure in your sense of self that you are not concerned about the opinions and the perceptions that others have of you. Now, does that mean that we need to ignore those opinions or perceptions? No, here's the difference. Most people take the opinions that others have of them as a determinant of their self-esteem. The leader takes the opinions that others have of them as a way of feedback on performance that they might want to change. You see, any opinion, any perception that another human being has of you is because of something that you have done. And the leader finds out what that triggering behavior was that caused the opinion. Then the leader has a choice. If they are committed to the person and the perception, they can change the behavior. But if they're more committed to the behavior than they are the perception, they stay true to themselves and they keep the behavior. You see, that's what security or sense of self is. It's being secure in your sense of self-esteem and using the opinions and perceptions of others only as feedback to be considered, not as a determinant of your self-worth. Let me ask you a question. I've asked this question to hundreds of audiences across the United States and Canada. Why do you get out of bed in the morning? Now, let me share with you the most common responses. The most common response is, number one, got to. No specific reason, just a compulsion that I have to get out of bed in the morning. Second most common response, because I've got to go to work. Now, what I'm about to say is not meant to be flippant or sarcastic, but it's true. In America, nobody really has to get out of bed in the morning. If you lie there long enough, somebody will come and take care of you. If your friends find out you're not getting out of bed, they'll bring you food. They'll come to care for you. If your relatives find out you're not leaving in the morning, they'll check up on you. And if you don't have friends or relatives, possibly someone from social services will stop by to see what's wrong. You see, nobody really has to get out of bed in the morning, and yet most of us do. High-impact leaders get out of bed in the morning because they have a clearly defined sense of purpose for their lives. You see, the power of leadership is in having a purpose. You know, there are over 10,000 ways to make money in America today. And to me, the most important question isn't what do you do for a living? The most important question is how do you feel about what you do for a living? According to two pieces of independent research done by Columbia and Stanford universities, somewhere between 81 and 87% of the American workforce is misemployed. That means that if you like what you do for a living, you are in an elite minority, because the majority of Americans get up in the morning and go to jobs that they do not enjoy. Let me give you a leadership axiom, and throughout the program, I'll share with you some leadership axioms. Here's one. If you don't enjoy what you do, it's time to do what you enjoy. Because what fuels high-impact leadership is a sense of purpose, the power that comes from being clearly directed in your life to knowing that you have a legitimate and valid reason why for the what that you do each day. There's a potential danger, however, in passion. You see, passion is created through a sense of purpose. But I notice that passion isn't always such a good thing. Every day I read the newspaper, I find an article about someone who has killed their lover, and they call it a crime of passion. Hitler was passionate, but he was a war criminal. You see, you can be passionate and still be wrong. There's got to be something that focuses the power of passion. If purpose produces passion, something must direct passion. And that's the third building block of self-mastery. You see, leaders have clearly defined values. Value makes sense out of passion. Value directs the energy of leaders. One of my favorite business philosophers is a man named Paul Hawken, successful entrepreneur who runs a company called Smith & Hawken Garden Tool Company in Mill Valley, California, author of the very successful book, Growing a Business. And Hawken says something that is so simple and yet profound. Hawken says, you and I must have values before we can add value. Ultimately, leaders have to answer three questions. I don't think in the time that we have today, you'll necessarily be able to answer all three of these, but over the next several weeks and months, I'd like you to work through these three questions. Question number one, what do you get excited about? One morning, a pastor stood before his congregation and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, my sermon this morning has only three points. Point number one, there are over 2 billion people starving to death on planet Earth. Point number two, most of you don't give a damn. And point number three, the greatest tragedy of our faith today is that more of you are angry that I said damn in church than you are that there are 2 billion people starving to death on planet Earth." You see, it's my conclusion that petty people get excited about petty issues, but significant people get excited about significant issues. You can tell a lot about a man or a woman by what they get excited about. Have you ever noticed that you can go to a football game, jump up and down, yell and scream, throw food, hug and kiss people that you do not know, and people will point at you and say, "Now there is a football fan." But if you leave the stadium and you get a little bit excited about your job or about your country or your spiritual values, people point at you, but they no longer call you a fan. Suddenly, you have moved into the realm of the fanatic. You see, the difference between fan and fanatic in America is what you get excited about. And personally, I don't have a problem with getting excited about professional sports. But I decided a long time ago that I would rather get excited about the values that have lasting meaning to me than a football team whose performance I hardly influence. You see, the first question of leadership is, what is it that you get excited about? Here's the second question. What is it that you stand for personally and organizationally? Let me tell you about the unhappiest people I know in America. They're the people that go into work in the morning and they have to sacrifice or put aside their own personal values and adopt a set of values in the workplace that they don't believe in or agree with. You see, I think one of the most important concepts for motivation in the 90s, especially for leaders, is alignment. Aligning yourself with people who share the same sense of purpose, the same values, and the same commitment. Now, in a very real world, we don't always have an opportunity to change the value system of where we work. And if, despite our best efforts, we are unable to do that, our second option is to realign ourselves with an organization who does share those values and commitments. The second question, what are the values that drive you personally, and what are the values that you believe should drive your organization? And number three, what do you do about your values? I had lunch with a woman who was actively involved in the animal rights movement. It was a fascinating conversation because that isn't an issue that I'm particularly close to. But I found out through my conversation with her that she devotes a great deal of her time and her money to animal rights issues. And she told me something that was fascinating. She said, you know, a lot of my friends, a lot of the people that I talk to are very critical of my involvement in animal rights, not because they disagree with animal rights, but because they say there are so many human issues that are more important. Homelessness, hunger and suffering, child abuse, issues that are more important than the rights of animals. And she said, I always quiet the critics by asking them one simple question. What are you doing about the human issues? You see, her point is simply that the people who are critical of her believe in the issues but do nothing about those things they believe in. They don't take action. At least she has taken action on an issue that she feels is important. I want to suggest today that there are actually two kinds of belief, or faith, if you will. First is what I call intellectual belief, intellectual faith. That means buying into mentally and agreeing with those values, those standards, those things that are important to you. But there's a more important kind of belief, and I call it pragmatic belief. And that's the real issue of leadership. Not just what you get excited about, not just what you believe in, but what do you do about your beliefs, what do you do about your values? The next component of self-mastery is called positive expectancy. In the past, we've referred to it as positive attitude or mental outlook. It's how you look at life. Whether you choose to focus on the problems or on the opportunities, whether you choose to focus on the setbacks or the things that will help you move forward. For years we've been poo-pooing this whole concept of positive thinking, but now we finally have quantitative proof from Dr. Martin Seligman, University of Pennsylvania. Seligman has studied the explanatory styles of people. He says there are two basic explanatory styles, positive and negative. He says that people with a positive explanatory style in the insurance industry sell 37% more insurance. He believes that explanatory style at age 25 is one of the best predictors of health at age 65. So you see, we now know that what we've always believed to be intuitively true is also valid and quantitatively true. And that is your view of the world, the positive expectancy that you have of it, impacts not only your own sense of self-mastery, but the confidence of the people around you. The fourth component of self-mastery is positive expectancy. Number five is discipline. Leadership axiom. We cannot demand excellence from others if we cannot command it from ourselves. I'm not sure where I picked up this definition, but somebody once defined professional as someone who does their best even when they don't feel like it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as someone that travels over 200 days a year on airplanes, that's the kind of pilot I want flying my airplanes. I want a professional, somebody who does their best even when they don't feel like it. How would you feel if you were on an airplane at the end of the runway? Thousands of pounds of raw steel and energy, you're about to take off, the pilot comes on the intercom and in a very low, melodious voice says, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard Flight 617. I'm Captain John Smith and, oh man, whew, what a night. My crew and I are going to try our best to get you safely to Chicago today." I'd say, let's go back to the gate, open the door. I do not want a pilot that is controlled by their emotions. I want a pilot that is controlled by their commitment to do their best even when they don't feel like it. The ability to do your best, despite the way you feel, is called discipline. And discipline is not something that is a particularly popular topic today because it implies a sense of self-denial, of delaying short-term gratification for long-term gratification. But let me suggest that there are two simple techniques that you and I can use to develop discipline as high-impact leaders. Here's the first. Every day, once a day, do something tough or challenging, not because you want to, not because you feel like it, but because you know it will be good for you. For several years, while I was living in Wisconsin, I was a competitive distance runner. 6 or 7 days a week, I would run 9 to 11 miles every night, and I would compete in races varying from 5 to 15 miles in length. I'll never forget my first 15-mile race. It was at about the 10 or 11-mile mark that I heard my mind speak to me audibly. My mind was saying, pull over, lie down underneath that tree, wait for help to come. Because I hurt and ached in every muscle in my body, every joint, and physically and intellectually my body wanted to stop. But I can remember one of the most significant breakthroughs that I made in my own sense of self-mastery was when I was able to override what my mind was telling me and my body was communicating and finish the race. Now, I'm not suggesting today that running is how you develop self-mastery through discipline. I'm suggesting that we all need that kind of a mechanism in our life. That every day we can prove to ourselves that we are in control and that we can choose to do what needs to be done, not just what we feel like doing. There is, however, a downside to discipline. And that is if, as leaders, we become too disciplined, we lose spontaneity and flexibility. And those are important skills, as I mentioned, for success in leadership in the 90s. I don't know how many of you will admit to having seen the intellectually stimulating movie Smokey and the Bandit. But believe it or not, there was one fairly philosophical scene in that movie. Sally Fields, who was the love interest of the bandit, played by Burt Reynolds, was asking Burt Reynolds why he led such a wild lifestyle. And for just a few moments in this otherwise silly movie, Burt Reynolds got very serious and he said, you know, my daddy worked very hard 7 days a week with one goal, and that is when he hit 55, he was going to retire and spend the rest of his life fishing. My daddy died of a heart attack when he was 53 years old. And on the day that he died, I made a commitment to myself that every day for the rest of my life, I would do at least one thing just for the pure heck of it. You see, the second way to develop discipline, as paradoxical as it sounds, is one day, every day, for the rest of your life, once a day, do something just for the pure fun of it. See, one of my fundamental life philosophies is on a placard at the beginning of a buffet line in a restaurant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. At the front of the buffet line, they have a dessert tray. Not where you'd expect to find the dessert tray, but the placard on the tray explains it all. It says, eat dessert first. Life is too tentative. The key to developing discipline is, number one, do something tough or challenging every day, but balance that with doing something just for the pure fun of it. Do not delay. Do not deny yourself of the simple pleasures of life along the way. Sixth component of self-mastery is what I call credibility through experience and competence. Credibility through experience and competence. You know, we tend to forget that one of the reasons why leaders have credibility is not because all of their experiences have been successful. You see, the first aspect of credibility in leadership comes not just from successful experience, but from having learned lessons from unsuccessful experiences, having learned from your failures. But the next part, then, is to develop credibility through competence. One of the most interesting and enjoyable companies that I've had a chance to work with is Dreyer's Grand Ice Cream in Oakland, California. Dreyer's is a $225 million a year company that makes the best ice cream in the United States. They have a very interesting management philosophy, what they call 10 management grooves, 10 values, if you will, 10 tracks that managers use for managing. And one of these management grooves is something that they call ownership. Let me just read a little bit about ownership from the Dreyer's Management Philosophy Manual. Each of us only goes around the track once in life, so we each owe it to ourselves to enjoy the journey. We think the best way for people to enjoy the part of their journey that involves working here at Dreyer's is to find some aspect of their job that they can own. If you become the best at some aspect of your job and are recognized as such by your coworkers, then you own it. If you go home with a smile on your face because you know you made a contribution others couldn't make as well, or because you are recognized by your coworkers as the best at some aspect of your job, then you have achieved ownership, and ownership is lots of fun. You see, credibility comes from being famous at something. Finding some aspect of your job, some aspect within your organization that you can do better than anybody else. I believe that to become famous or to have ownership requires three sub-masteries, three things that you've got to be able to do to create ownership. The first I call mastery of craft. You see, people who are really good at what they do appear to almost be magical. They appear to be natural borns. Because when it comes to mastery of craft, there are only four levels that you can be at as a high-impact leader. Chances are, if you're a high-impact leader, you are not at the first level. That is called unconscious incompetence. Those are people that do not know, but do not know that they do not know. The second level, and typically where we start to identify managers, is what we call conscious incompetence. The good news is you know that you've got some deficit of skills that you've got to develop. But the third level, and where most people spend most of their lives, is a level called conscious competence. That is, by concentrating and working very hard, you are able to have some sense of mastery over what it is that you're doing. But where I want to be when it comes to mastery of craft is something called unconscious competence. That is when you're so good at what you do that it comes naturally, that it appears to require little or no effort, and that from a personal sense, you don't really feel like you're trying. But you've just done it so much, you've imprinted that particular skill, and now you own it. That is called the mastery of craft. Eric Hoffer, the longshoreman philosopher, said you can tell the difference between a craftsman and a laborer by the sweat on their brow. You see, the master is more focused, more intense about what it is that they're doing, and that has allowed them to achieve, number one, mastery of craft. Number two, if you are going to create credibility through experience and through mastery, you must master interactions. You can't master people. And the reason for that is simple. If you and I depend on our ability to change other people, we will be severely handicapped in the marketplace of life. There are some people we can change. There are some people we can improve. There are some people who we will never be able to change. Therefore, we have to understand the law of behavioral flexibility. The greatest freedom I have is the ability and willingness to change myself. You see, if the problem I'm having with you is the way I interact with you, I can change the way I interact. If the problem I'm having is the way I respond to you, I can change the way that I respond. To be a master of interactions means that you choose to control your interactions and responses with people, and that will give you complete control of any situation. You can't master, you can't control people, but you can master and control interactions. And finally, number three, mastery of process. One of my favorite books is called The Executive Odyssey by Frederick Harmon. Excellent book, I'd highly recommend it. But Harmon says, the building block of success in the workplace is the complete act. The complete act is when you have a very clear picture of what you're trying to accomplish and you are able to accomplish that task completely and successfully. Harmon says, however, that most executives miss successfully completing the act because they don't understand that there are three subtle components to the complete act. The first is called the physical component, what I call the detail part of the complete act. Now, the higher you move up in an organization and the more developed you become as a leader, the more difficult it is to identify the physical component. But let me share just a couple of examples with you. If you're making an important presentation and the overhead projector bulb burns out, you realize that there was a physical aspect of your presentation you neglected, and that is to check the spare bulb to see if it worked. If you're making an important business trip and you get to the airport in the city of your destination only to find out that there are no rental cars available, you realize that you've missed the physical component of the complete act. You haven't called ahead and reserved the car in advance. So you see, the complete act, at least the physical component, is probably what caused advertising genius David Ogilvy to say, God is in the details. The second component of the complete act is called the mental component. I call it the thinking part of the complete act. It is the ability to concentrate on a task, to plan it and organize it, and maximize your effort. Research suggests that for every 1 hour of planning we invest, we can expect to save somewhere between 2 to 3 hours of execution. You see, the mental component is focusing on the task and figuring out how to think your way to a better process and to a better outcome. But finally, the third component, and again, often overlooked, is called the psychological component. I call it the people aspect of the complete act. Now, the psychological component takes into account how people will affect the organization, coordination, and implementation of the plan, and how the plan will affect the way that people feel. You see, it's taking into account the feelings of the people that you work with and making sure that you've enlisted their support. If you want to have credibility through experience and through competency, you must have control of the complete act. And Frederick Harmon says the complete act is all three things: physical, mental, and psychological. The seventh and final component to self-mastery is continual growth through study and introspection. Have you ever noticed that paradox about your profession or about your hobbies and your passions, that the more you learn, the more you realize you need to learn? Michelangelo is reputed to have said at the peak of his career, "Still I am learning." You see, that's the final challenge of self-mastery, is continual growth. Travel is a humbling experience. You know, the more I travel, the bigger the world becomes. I think it would be a good idea, if not a requirement, that all high-impact leaders spend some time every 2 or 3 years overseas acquainting themselves with a new culture and a new way of looking at things. It's important that we get outside of the world that we live in most of the time and expose ourselves to new experiences. As a matter of fact, one of the unlearned skills of high-impact leadership is unlearning the lessons of the past. Alvin Toffler, who wrote the book Future Shock, said that the challenge in the future will be to learn, unlearn, and relearn. You see, we can't hold too tightly to the lessons of past experience, because in a rapidly changing world, what we've learned last week or last month or last year may no longer be relevant or applicable. Where I used to live in Philadelphia, there was a hairstyling salon, a very successful salon. You had to call 2 weeks in advance to get an appointment. At the time, and this was several years ago, a man's haircut was $25 before tip. Right next door, however, there was an excellent little bookshop, and I can't ever remember being in that bookshop when there was more than 2 or 3 other people in there at the same time. You see, people are much more willing to invest in their appearance than they are to invest in their growth. As my friend Patricia Welling puts it so eloquently, she says, "It's possible to be vogue on the outside, but vague on the inside." If you want to get more from your life experiences, there are two keys. The first is to precede every significant life experience with study, and the next key is to follow up every significant life experience with introspection. Let's talk first about study. Study is becoming a student of ideas and people. It's estimated that less than 1 out of every 10 people who buys a book ever reads beyond the first chapter. Most people never take time to listen to an educational audio cassette tape. We don't attend enough seminars to expose ourselves to new ideas. But you see, the way that we increase the lessons of experience is if we precede that experience with relevant study. The more important missing step is, after we've had that experience, asking ourselves, what lessons have we learned? Introspection is reflecting not on what you did, but how you felt about what you did and what you learned from it. In 1979, I was traveling about 320 days that year, and I kept a very detailed journal of my experiences. Last year, when I went to South America, I kept a journal of my trip, and I compared the two journals when I came back. In 1979, I was writing about what happened to me. But in 1989, I was writing about how I felt about those experiences and what I had learned from them. You see, I had made that shift from simply experiencing into introspection. Because experiences without introspection become relatively void of value. The lessons come from thinking about what has happened rather than just experiencing it. I think the best high-impact leaders don't just learn from their business lives, but they learn from all areas of their lives. I had a gentleman write me a letter, and he shared an interesting story from his introspection. His name is Terry Truman. He's a thinking manager leader. At the end of his letter, he shares this little story. He says, "In The Pope of Greenwich Village, a book by Vincent Patrick, a woman played by Daryl Hannah in the movie tells her Italian boyfriend, Mickey Rourke, that he has outgrown his ne'er-do-well cousin, Eric Roberts. The boyfriend says, 'Italians outgrow suits, not people.' I think we see a lot of this as managers. The company grows and some people don't grow along as fast, but the leading edge manager will make the effort to help these folks grow with the company. Companies shouldn't outgrow people either." Excellent example of what I mean by the leader using introspection to get more out of their life experiences. You see, the seventh and final component of self-mastery is continual growth, enhancing experience both through study and introspection. The second skill of high-impact leadership is stewardship, and I define stewardship as the strategic use of resources. My formal education is in economics. And occasionally people will ask me how I got into the speaking and training business. I tell them that economics is actually the study of the allocation of resources for maximum return on their investment. What we're talking about in leadership, of course, is the most valuable resource of all, and that is the human resource. Leaders really only have three resources. Very often when I ask people, what is your scarcest resource, they will tell me money. But you see, money isn't a resource. Money is a byproduct of how you invest these other three resources. The first and scarcest resource of leadership is time. The second scarcest resource is energy. That's why it's important that if you don't enjoy what you're doing, do what you enjoy, because the power of passion is what gives you energy as a leader. But the third scarcest resource for leaders today are the time and energy of other people. You see, leadership is the strategic use of those three resources, your own time, your own energy, and the time and energy of others. Very often I hear people say that time is money. It's not, because you can enjoy time without money, but you cannot enjoy money without time. Here's the leadership axiom I'd like you to make a mental note of. Managers try to put more time in their lives. Leaders try to put more life in their time. Realizing that time is a limited resource whose flow we cannot interrupt, we've got to be able to strategically deploy that very precious resource. The concept that I'm about to share with you may well be the most powerful in this entire program. It's very simple, but it's incredibly powerful. And it is the concept of focus. You see, what most creates results for leaders is how they focus their efforts and their attention. It is also what gives leadership credibility. We say, for instance, in corporate America that customer service is important, but of course we've all been behind closed doors in meetings for the last 3 weeks, and we haven't seen a real living, breathing customer. We say that quality is an issue in our organization, but when was the last time the company's leadership put on some work clothes, working with the people responsible for producing quality, to make sure that they had what it is they needed? And I've heard upper management leadership say that they believe in innovation, and yet last week they fired somebody who took a risk and cost the company a little bit of money. And of course, maybe the biggest irony is when leaders talk about the importance of people, but we haven't seen them or spent any quality time one-on-one because they've been too busy with other things. You see, focus is the most powerful aspect of the deployment of your resources, because what you spend your time doing is what you are able to accomplish. I actually learned this from rodents. A friend of mine named Bill Sanders in Kalamazoo, Michigan, is also a professional speaker. Now, my therapy, the way I try to keep my sanity, is by spending as much time as I can in the mountains. But Bill likes to feed birds. Several years ago, he bought a new home, and one of the first things he did over the weekend was build a bird feeder in the backyard. He filled it up with feed. Within 20 minutes, squirrels were swinging off his bird feeder, eating the feed, scaring the birds away. Before the sun set that night in Kalamazoo, Michigan, squirrels were swinging off the squirrel-proof bird feeder, scaring the birds away and causing Bill a great deal of anxiety. Now Bill is really angry. He rips down the squirrel-proof bird feeder and on Monday morning goes back into the hardware store, slams it down on the counter, and says to the store manager, "I demand my money back. This is not a squirrel-proof bird feeder." Store manager responded very calmly, looked at Bill, and he said, "Well, of course not. I could have told you before you purchased it. There is no such thing as a squirrel-proof bird feeder." Bill said, "Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that we can put a space shuttle into space on a regular basis? We can communicate anywhere in the free world in 3 to 5 seconds. And that our best scientific minds and engineers cannot design and manufacture a squirrel-proof bird feeder? Are you trying to tell me that a rodent with a brain the size of a pea can outsmart our best attempts to keep them out of a bird feeder? Is that what you're trying to tell me?" Store manager said, "Yes, sir, I am. I'm just not taking as much time to tell you." Bill said, "Why is that? Just do me a favor. Before you give me my money back, explain this to me." Store manager said, "I'd be glad to." He said, "Mr. Sanders, number one, how much time have you spent on average each day in the past 2 weeks thinking about how to keep the squirrels out of your bird feeder?" Bill thinks about it for a minute. He says, "On average, maybe 5 or 10 minutes a day." Store manager said, "Yeah, that's what I thought." He said, "Second question, how much time do you think the squirrels have spent each day thinking about how to get in?" The answer? Every waking squirrel moment. You want to know what the lesson of the squirrel-proof bird feeder is? Success does not respect intelligence nearly as much as success respects focused attention. We all know people in the world who are incredibly bright, but they're stone-cold poor and unsuccessful. And likewise, I'm sure that like me, you know a few people who have limited intellect, but they're successful beyond their wildest dreams. Why is that? It's because focused attention and effort will beat brilliance every time in the marketplace of human affairs. You see, I'm not so presumptuous today as to suggest to you what your top three or five priorities in life should be, but I can guarantee you as I stand here that if you focused 50 to 75% of every working day on those top three to five priorities, you would see significant progress in those areas. You see, this whole idea of focused attention and effort goes back to something that was validated in some research done by Warren Bennis and Bert Nanis. These two gentlemen wrote a seminal book on leadership called Leaders, Strategies for Taking Charge. They interviewed 90 of the most successful business leaders in America to find out what they shared in common. They were able to reduce their findings down into two sentences that appeared on the dust jacket of the book. Here's what the sentences said. Managers do things right. Leaders do the right things. You see, they found that the differentiating factor between managers and leaders was the difference between being efficient and being effective. Efficient means no wasted time, energy, or motion. It means doing things right. But there's a critical difference between being efficient and being effective. Effective means doing the right things. You see, it doesn't matter how efficient we are as leaders or managers unless we're focused on the right things. When I was in college, one of my good friends named Jeff Slutsky decided to drive from his home in Columbus, Ohio, to Fort Lauderdale for spring break. He was going to make this trip with his roommate, and they decided to try to set a new land speed record. It should have been a 24-25-hour trip. They were going to try to do it in 18 to 19 hours. They both decided they would stay awake to keep the other awake. They started off early one morning, about 10 or 12 hours into the trip. They were starting to get so groggy from lack of sleep that they got off the interstate to get a cup of coffee to go. They got their coffee, but when they got back on the interstate, they were still delirious enough that inadvertently they started heading back north. That was about an hour before they noticed. Jeff started to see some of the same scenery, some of the same road signs, some of the same exits. So finally, he turns to his roommate who is driving. He says, "Hey, I think we're going the wrong way." His roommate's got both hands clenched tightly on the wheel. He says, "Yeah, but we're making great time." You see, a perfect example of the difference between efficient and effective. Efficient is doing 70 miles an hour. Effective is heading in the right direction. If you want to become a high-impact leader, let me suggest that you identify for yourself and for the people you lead their MVP activities. MVP in sports stands for most valuable player. In business and in life, MVP stands for most valuable and profitable activities. First, what I'd suggest you do for yourself is make a list of those 10 activities, those 10 things that you should be and could be doing each day that would give you the biggest payback on your investment of time and energy. Come up with a list of 10 and prorate them, one being the most important, 10 being the least important. If you report to someone higher up in your organization, ask them to develop this same list for you. In other words, ask them to put together a list of the 10 things they believe you should be and could be devoting the majority of your day to each day. Those 10 MVP activities, ask them to prorate the list. Then at some point in the future, compare your MVP list with a list that your boss has. Because you see, if your number one on your list is your boss's number nine, you need to talk about that. If your boss's number two isn't even on your list, you need to negotiate that. What I want to do is develop a list of those 10 most valuable and profitable activities that every employee, myself included, should spend the majority of time focusing on. That's how you can become effective, not just personally, but organizationally. The strategic use of resources, especially time and energy, requires three time consciousnesses. To be time conscious, you must be conscious of three aspects of time. The first is what we call future focus. Now, the key to future focus as a high-impact leader is called strategic anticipation. I grew up on a dairy farm, and being involved for many years in agriculture, one of the things that we learned is that it was important to expect the best but plan for the worst. You see, positive expectancy says you've got to have a positive attitude about the possibilities of the future, but being a realist means you also need to have contingency plans. Managers ask the question, what if we fail? Leaders ask the question, what will we do if we fail? Successful leaders, whether it's men in the sports or military or business, always have contingency plans to fall back on. They are always anticipating moment to moment what might happen in the future. Similar to the analogy of the airline pilot who is continually correcting his course during the flight. Leaders must be continually anticipating problems that could arise and what they will do, what actions they'll take in response to those problems. Future focus requires strategic anticipation. Past focus is primarily to learn the lessons of the past. The biggest value in history and past experience is what works and what doesn't work and how to apply it to the present. But probably the third most important time consciousness is to be present focused. High-impact leaders know wherever you're at, you need to be there. Most of us are time warpers. We're preoccupied with things of the past or things of the future. As you drive into work in the morning, you're thinking about all the things you have to do that day. You run somebody off the road, they're still in the ditch, you don't know it. You get into work and you start to wonder where you're going to eat lunch. And when you're eating lunch, you start to worry about the afternoon, and in the afternoon, you start to wonder about the evening. And as a result, we're never fully engaged. A French theologian once said that we should live every moment in the present moment as if there were nothing to expect beyond it. See, that's the key to being present focused. We must anticipate the future. We must learn from the past. But leaders, high impact leaders, spend the majority of their time focused in the present. One final idea when it comes to the strategic use of resources. Most people don't know the difference between excellence and perfectionism. I used to be a card-carrying perfectionist until a clinical psychologist defined perfectionism for me. He said, "Mark, did you know that perfectionism is a neurotic attention to detail, usually stemming from insecurity?" I decided maybe I didn't want to be a perfectionist anymore. I think, however, if you tend to be a perfectionist, you've got an easy scapegoat. You can blame your parents or your teachers. Because early on in our educational development, we had an adult in our life who said, "Anything worth doing is worth doing well." That, ladies and gentlemen, is simply untrue. Some things are worth doing and getting done. Some things are worth doing well. Some things are worth doing very, very well. Excellence is the ability to know the difference. Thomas Jefferson once said, "I never want to invent anything that nobody wants to buy." Now, using Thomas Jefferson's philosophy, let me define excellence for you. Excellence means investing additional time and energy as long as it makes the product or service noticeably better to the end user. In other words, I don't want to spend time on a project, on an activity, or on a service unless it adds value to that product or service. And value, of course, is defined by the person who takes delivery of it, because that's the person in the best perspective to evaluate. The second skill of high-impact leadership is stewardship, the strategic use of resources. The third skill of high-impact leadership is visioning. Visioning is coming up with a blueprint for the future. Leadership axiom. Managers provide people with destination. Leaders provide people with transportation. You see, it's one thing to be able to envision the future. It's quite another to be able to show people how to get there. Bobby Kennedy was a man of great political vision. He once said, "Some men see things as they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not." You see, that's the beginning of vision. Theodore Levitt, the marketing guru at Harvard Business School, says, "The future belongs to those who see opportunities before they become obvious." What I want to talk about in this section is how you can not only come up with a vision of the future, but how you can show people how to achieve it. Because a good blueprint has a picture not only of the final structure, but the details of what it'll take to construct it. Jacques Delors is the president of the European Commission. If Jacques and his team are successful, by December 31st, 1992, they will have merged 12 separate European nations into one common group with no barriers of 320 million consumers. Now, the people that have been observing Delors as he's tried to undertake this incredible task have said that he is successful because he spends relatively little time thinking about the grand vision and much more time consumed by the gritty details. That's what I'd like you to make note of. We already know that vision is grand, but there's a second component to vision, and that second component includes the gritty details of implementation or execution. How do you develop a vision? Well, to develop a vision, begin at the end and work backwards. If you are a leader for a limited period of time, ask yourself, what 3 to 5 things will this organization accomplish under my leadership? If you're an ongoing leader within an organization, hold yourself accountable year to year. What 3 to 5 things has the team accomplished this year as a result of my input and my influence? But vision always begins with beginning at the end and asking the simple question, what is it that I'm trying to accomplish? Now, very often when we talk about leadership, we say that leaders are proactive. Let me give you a different view of the future. In a very chaotic and rapidly changing world, it is difficult to be proactive. Many people are reactive. They simply wait for things to happen and respond. In the past, it's believed that leaders are proactive, that leaders make things happen. Let me suggest that in the 1990s, leaders must be interactive. Now, what does it mean to be interactive? It means the ability to adapt and change very quickly. I like what futurist Dan Burris says. Dan Burris says, what will you be when you grow up? Don't worry about it, because half of what you could be hasn't even been invented yet. That's what it means to be interactive. It is recognizing that we have an imperfect view of the future, that we don't have a crystal ball, and that simply having a very rigidly defined vision is not enough, that we've got to be flexible enough to interact with the future as it occurs if we are going to be successful. What I'd like to explain right now is how you can go about reinventing your world, reinventing the way that you do business. I call it the pursuit of more, better, faster, and different. The pursuit of more, of course, is quantity. The pursuit of better is quality. The pursuit of faster is speed, and the pursuit of different is innovation. Let me give you some examples from the business world of how leaders and organizations have reinvented the way they do business, how they've reinvented their products and their services. Let's start by talking about the pursuit of more. One of my favorite restaurants is a little family restaurant called the Black Eyed Pea. If you've ever eaten the Black Eyed Pea, you'll know that they don't do anything significantly different than other restaurants. But they do everything a little more, and in some cases, better or faster. For instance, the food that they serve you, it comes in a larger portion. It comes in less than 5 minutes. The speed of service is very quick. The cost of the most expensive item on the menu is no more than $5.95. So you see, the way they've reinvented the way they do business is not by radically changing any aspect of their restaurant, but by doing everything with a focus on more, being quantity, or a little bit faster, a little bit better. What about the pursuit of better, the pursuit of quality? I had a chance to work with a company in Missoula, Montana called Sun Mountain Sports. Sun Mountain Sports makes a very innovative and high-quality golf bag. One of the reasons that they're successful is because their founder was a professional golfer, and he intimately understood his hobby and his business. In one of their catalogs, though, they have a segment on being the best, and better than anything else I could share with you today, this explains what I mean by the pursuit of better, the pursuit of quality. We believe there is no better material or process to be used in any of our products. Nylon is the finest grade from the best mill and the best finishing house in the U.S. We don't fudge by mixing in seconds. Our thread was chosen for its heavy weight, durability, and consistency. Less expensive brands are fine 98% of the time. However, we won't accept a 2% chance of failure. Leather trim comes from premium grade treated 6 to 6.5 ounce boot grade cowhide. Cheaper grades abound, but we will not have thin, dried out, curled up reinforcement patches at critical stress points. Zippers are equally important. Nothing is more frustrating than a perfectly good golf bag with a ball pocket made useless because of a bad zipper. We used the famous Japanese name brand zipper until an American company proved that theirs was better. Very successful in their marketplace because they focused on the pursuit of better, the pursuit of quality. What about the pursuit of faster, the pursuit of speed? How many of you have eaten a Domino's pizza in the last 60 to 90 days? Quick show of hands. Yeah, a number of us have ordered and eaten a Domino's pizza. Now, let me ask you a quick question. Did you order the Domino's pizza because it was without a doubt the tastiest pizza that you could buy in your neighborhood? My guess is probably not. Domino's pizza is good pizza, but it's not great pizza. If it's not the best pizza you can get in your neighborhood, why did you order it? Because it was fast. How fast? 30 minutes or less. Most people don't know their own corporate mission statement, but they've memorized Domino's mission statement, which is to deliver a hot, tasty pizza in 30 minutes or less. Now notice, in all due respects to Domino's, they do not focus on quality. They do not focus on quantity. What do they focus on? Speed. Speed is the differentiating factor that has made them one of the most successful pizza chains in the world. By the way, I figured out how they do that. They fill up these vehicles with pizzas, they park them all over town. You know who they get to drive them? Psychics. You get a little bit hungry, and while you're dialing the phone, the pizza delivery psychic's running the pizza up to your front door. You know, today in Japan, pizza delivery is so competitive that they actually print the results on the front page of the sports section. Domino's Pizza, 9.2 minutes. Fuji Pizza, 7.8 minutes. That's because the critical differentiating factor in that particular marketplace is not just the quality of the pizza, but the speed with which it's delivered. Let me give you your goal for the future as a high-impact leader. High-impact leaders understand their followers' and their customers' needs so well that they anticipate those needs and fulfill those needs before the customer or follower knows they have them. It's the ability to anticipate needs and fulfill those needs before they become consciously aware to the follower or to the customer. Of course, my favorite pursuit is the pursuit of different. That's innovation. I worked with an electrical contractor in the Midwest, very successful, Piper Electric, 305 electricians. Have you ever had an electrician come into your office or your home or your plant? Well, electricians tend to be messy. They're one of the messiest contractors you'll ever work with. Wires and shavings and stuff all over the place. Piper Electric knew they were doing business in a competitive industry, so they decided to do something a little bit different. They gave all of their electricians handheld shop vacs. Not an expensive investment, but they made sure that every electrician had this handheld shop vac and that they were instructed to clean up after themselves when they finished a project at the worksite. Now, it's amazing the letters that the president of Piper Electric gets. Not just about the quality of the workmanship, because people expected the workmanship to be good. But what set Piper Electric apart was, as one customer put it, the fact that the worksite was cleaner after the electrician left than before they came. You see, they reinvented the way they did business. They were innovative not by doing anything high-tech, but by using some common sense to create value for their customers in the marketplace. How many of you have ever stayed at a DoubleTree Inn? DoubleTree is an interesting hotel. As far as I know, the carpet is the same as other hotels, the front desk and the registration, the walls, the beds, the rooms. But what do you remember about DoubleTree Inn? Let me tell you what I remember. Every night at 8 o'clock, they bring two freshly baked chocolate chip cookies to your room. Now, I will drive 25 miles out of my way to stay at a DoubleTree Inn so that I can get two freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. Is that a valid reason for making a business decision? Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. Because any other hotel I stay at, everything's pretty much the same, but DoubleTree has innovated by making chocolate chip cookies available at night. But if you want an example of how you can pursue more, better, faster, and different, you should make a visit to the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Cherry Creek, a suburb of Denver, Colorado. Now, the Tattered Cover isn't really a bookstore. It is a book experience. Go into the Tattered Cover on a weekend, and it looks like the last day of shopping before Christmas, packed with people, high level of energy. You see, the Tattered Cover Bookstore has 100,000 book titles on three levels. They've got another 75,000 titles in their computer. That means there's a total of over 400,000 books in 41,000 square feet. That is 10 times more than their competitor, B. Dalton. The Tattered Cover is an amazing bookstore from a number of other vantage points. For instance, at the Tattered Cover, they take 250 to 350 special book orders every day. Some by phone, some taken in person. But if you order a book, when the book comes in, they will send you a notification in the mail. This says your book is in. If in 2 weeks you haven't come in to pick up your book, they'll call you on the phone. When you finally come in to get your book, if it isn't exactly what you expected, if it isn't a book that you want to buy, no problem. They'll eat the cost of the book. Now, this is a practice that's almost unheard of in the book retailing business. Tattered Cover also publishes four newsletters a year. I brought one of the newsletters with me today because I like the list of services and what's free on the back. Underneath services, it says, books by phone. If there's a book you wish to purchase and cannot do so in person, the Tattered Cover is only a phone call away. They will mail any purchase via UPS or fourth class book rate from the point of purchase, or if you care to, you can have a book mailed by phone. They do special ordering for free. They book cater events. We will provide books for conferences, meetings, and book fairs. They have gift certificates, a store charge account for people like me that spend 10% of their disposable income at the Tattered Cover. And of course, they have extended hours. They're open evenings. Underneath the list of what's free, it says free covered parking, free gift wrapping, free toll-free numbers, both inside and outside of Colorado. They have free browsing, overstuffed chairs, dark stained veneer on the shelves, and it creates the ambience of a library where you're free to come and browse for as long as you want. But you know what's most impressive to me? The 225 employees that work at the Tattered Cover actually enjoy their jobs and are friendly. They don't ask for ID when you cash a check. They have a very liberal return policy. You see, their attitude is most of our customers are fair and honest people, so why make rules for the few that aren't? And of course, the leadership for this book phenomenon, the woman who conceived the idea and who grew the business to where it is today, is a woman named Joyce Meskis. I've been so impressed with the way that Joyce Meskis has been able to reinvent the book retailing business that I decided to interview her. Now, Joyce and the Tattered Cover have been written about by business publications and newspapers all over the United States, including the New York Times. But I met with Joyce in the basement, in a very humble office, kind of tucked away in the corner, and I asked her to share her ideas on leadership. First, I asked her what her purpose was, because I said that high-impact leaders have a sense of purpose. Her purpose isn't complicated, but it's very straightforward. Her purpose is to bring books and people together. I said, Joyce, how do you define success? And she said, well, success is different things to different people. But then she said, to us at the Tattered Cover, success is doing business in a way that is true to our own philosophy and good for the community. Now, there's a couple of ideas you don't typically hear about in business leadership today. Being true to your own philosophy and values and making sure that you're being of service to the community. What's probably the most challenging part of Joyce's job is as the Tattered Cover grows to make sure that the values and the vision that she had at the beginning continue to be perpetuated. Now, you need to remember that Joyce has been in the book business for 29 years. She was an avid reader ever since childhood. She's worked in libraries and bookstores, and in 1973, she started her own bookshop in Parker, Colorado. It failed for reasons not completely of her own, but she didn't let that set her back. In 1974, she purchased the Tattered Cover in Cherry Creek. She then set about to slowly build this book phenomenon, and the way that she did it is, number one, through selecting only people to work in her business who are service-oriented. She said it's her belief that people who like books and people who like people shouldn't necessarily bring the two together, that you've got to be service-oriented first and foremost if you want to work at the Tattered Cover. Do you know when they interview people, the interview lasts for 1 hour, and the first 30 minutes of the interview, the Tattered Cover spends talking to the potential employee, basically trying to convince them not to take the job, trying to scare them to death to make sure that only the best people will come on board, people who share the same values and commitment. They also talk about their commitment to First Amendment issues because they very actively support First Amendment rights, freedom of choice, the freedom of speech. And Joyce says, you know, most people when they do an interview, they like to listen. She says that they think what we do is a little unorthodox, but here's what we've learned. How well a potential employee listens to us during the interview suggests how well they'll listen to a customer who has a problem. Well, for the last 30 minutes of the interview, they ask some typical questions to the employee, and if they feel there's a good fit between that employee and the Tattered Cover, they hire them. The employee's first day on the job, the entire day is spent with Joyce Meskis. Now, originally, she did these meetings one-on-one. Now, as they're growing, they do these in small groups. But for one entire day, Joyce gives them a behind-the-scenes look at the Tattered Cover, gets to know them personally, shares some of herself, and then she focuses on what she calls book-selling Tattered Cover style. You see, she's big on nuance. She suggests certain phrases that have been tested to be best for using with customers. She teaches people to listen with their ears and their eyes. She covers the nuances of body language. They've even developed a video, great name, The Good, The Bad, and The Okay. And in the video, they have different examples of exchanges with customers and how to maximize that exchange, how to build the relationship with the customer. It's what Joyce Meskis calls sweating the details. Remember I said vision is both grand and gritty? Joyce devotes much of her time to the gritty aspects, sweating the details of her vision. When she talks about employees, she uses words like community and inclusive. And it's very important to her that even though they're not perfect and they're going through some growing pains from time to time, it's very important to her that employees know that they're trying. She says problem solving is best accomplished by pushing the problem down to where it happens, and that they empower people to make judgment calls on their own, and that managers are only around if necessary to deal with a problem if the employee feels uncomfortable doing it themselves. Finally, I said to Joyce, what do you see as your role as leader? And she said, well, I guess I'm a leader to the degree that I have an overview of operations and where the store should go. But I see it more as a joint effort rather than a singular effort. She says, to be very honest with you, I don't spend much time thinking about my role. I just do it. I concluded by saying, Joyce, you know, what's impressed me as I've talked to you is that you obviously like what you're doing. And Joyce smiled back and said, no, I love it. High-impact leadership is the pursuit of more, better, different, and faster. And Joyce Meskis in The Tattered Cover has been able to accomplish that. The chief executive officer of a large company was trying to find a new president for his organization. He decided that he wanted to promote from within, so he decided to interview three of his top managers. He was going to ask them all the same question to see what kind of philosophical response they might make. The question was, what's 2 plus 2? To the vice president of engineering, he said, what's 2 plus 2? VP of engineering didn't even think about it. He said, 4. Always has been, always will be. To the vice president of sales, he said, what's 2 plus 2? VP of sales said, 4, but it would be nice if it was 395. To the vice president of finance, he said, what's 2 plus 2? VP of finance thought about it for a moment and said, what would you like it to be? The VP of finance got the job. Why? Creativity. He was able to look at the situation a little bit differently and come up with something that wasn't a preconceived notion of how the world should be. I'd like you to remember, however, that there's a difference between creativity and innovation. You see, managers attempt to be creative. High-impact leaders strive to be innovative. Here's the difference. Have you ever read an article in a magazine about a successful product, the idea for which you had 5 or 10 years ago? Problem is, you didn't make any money, and today somebody is wealthy because of an idea that you had long before they did. You see, creativity is a head game. Innovation is a doing game. It doesn't do much good to be creative if you can't translate those ideas into reality in the workplace. What I'd like to quickly explain are 5 techniques for becoming more creative and innovative, for coming up with better ideas that you can implement to change and improve the way that you do business. Number 1, begin by daring to be different. John Stuart Mill said, one of the chief dangers of our time is that so few dare to be eccentric. You see, managers try to fit the mold, but leaders try to create their own mold. Daring to be different means that you should go outside your industry for ideas on how to improve the way you do business. Many of us become very myopic. That means focused on only what is directly in front of us. If you only do what's been done in your industry before, you'll never be known as innovative. One of my clients in Cincinnati, Ohio, is La Rosa's, a chain of Italian restaurants, very well-managed company. They have a company van, and from time to time, they'll load up the van with top managers, and they'll go visit a restaurant in another city or even another state. That's because they're continually looking for ideas outside their own restaurant for better ways to do business. Now, the only way that you might improve on that is actually go outside your industry. Visit a different kind of business in a different type of industry. But the second thing you can do if you want to dare to be different is to ask a non-expert. Next time you've got a problem, ask somebody who doesn't know anything about your area of expertise. Walk down the hallway, interview someone from a different department. Better yet, pick up the phone and call somebody who's completely outside your industry. Because a non-expert can give you a different perspective that will be helpful in creatively solving the problem. Number 1, you want to be more creative and innovative, dare to be different. Number 2, make sure that you're answering the correct questions. Let me give you a quick pop quiz to illustrate a point. On a piece of paper, I'd like you to jot down the 3 brief answers to these 3 questions. Now, this is not a group exercise. Please don't get excited and yell the answer out loud. Working independently, question number 1, how many birthdays does the average American male have? How many birthdays does the average American male have? Question number 2, some months have 30 days, some have 31. How many months have 28 days? Question number 3 is a mathematical question. Divide 30 by 1/2 and add 10. What is the answer? Now, how many of you would like to bet dinner tonight that you got all three of those questions correct? Well, if you're confident enough to bet, I probably shouldn't take the wager, but let's look at the questions. Question number one, how many birthdays does the average American male have?
One.
Exactly. Mine's June 28th, if you'd like to send a gift or a card. Now, some of you have written down 72. 72 is the correct answer to the wrong question. You see, you answered the question, how old does the average American male live to be? But the question I asked is, how many birthdays does the average American male have? And the answer to that question is one. Number two, some months have 30 days, some have 31. How many months have 28 days?
All
of them. Now, the nonverbal is giving a few of you away. Some of you wrote down one because you were, again, answering with the correct answer but to the wrong question. If the answer to question number two was one, the month of February, you were answering the question, how many months have only 28 days? And finally, number three, if you divide 30 by 1/2 and add 10, the answer is
70.
Because you see, 1/2 goes into 30 60 times. Add 10, the answer is 70. Most people will write down 25. 25 is what happens if you divide 30 by 2 and add 10. What's my point? My point is, in business today, the answers that we come up with are correct, but they're answering the wrong questions. Somebody changed the questions, but we keep answering the old questions with the correct answers, but the questions have changed. Number two, make sure you're answering the correct questions. Define your problem or challenge carefully. Number three, search for all the right answers. Search for all the right answers. Psychologists that specialize in creativity believe that between the ages of 5 and 7, the average child loses 50% of their innate creativity. Now, what significant life event occurs between the ages of 5 and 7 that somehow contributes to sapping away 50% of a child's creativity? Well, they start school. And there's nothing inherently wrong with our educational system, except that one of the unfortunate byproducts is that our school system teaches people to search for the right answer. And creativity is a search for the right answers. Stop to think about this. When you started taking multiple choice tests in school, if you circled A and C, the teacher put a big red X through your answer and said, there's only one right answer. If you took a fill-in-the-blank test and there were two blanks and you wrote in three words, the teacher put an X through your answer and said, there's only one right answer. Let me share with you what I call Sanborn's maxim of creativity. And it goes like this. The quicker you find the solution to any problem, the less likely it is the best solution. If we are going to generate quality solutions, we must have some options, some alternatives to choose from. So number three, to be innovative, do not seek the right answer, but try to identify all of the right answers and then choose the best from among those alternatives. Number four, learn to act on incomplete information. You've probably heard the phrase before, but many of us suffer from the paralysis of analysis. We gather information and data, we do our research and our homework until we make the decision far too late. You see, what you have to remember is that being informed is not necessarily the same as having complete information. Sometimes complete information is sufficient, and that's because intuition is the bridge between what we know and what we don't know. Creative and innovative people use intuition to make that leap from the amount of information they have to the best solution. To be more innovative more quickly, number four, learn to act on incomplete information. And finally, number five, probably the most common advice given when it comes to creativity and innovation, be willing to make more mistakes. Be willing to live with imperfection. As a matter of fact, 3M believes that fully 50% of all of their new product introductions were initially product failures. The fifth piece of advice, to be more innovative, be willing to make more mistakes, be willing to live with imperfection. Now, when it comes to visioning and reinventing the future, we can't ignore the fact that from time to time, problems will arise organizationally. Let me talk about the role of high-impact leadership in problem solving. The leader is responsible for doing several things. First, the leader must leverage the problem into the conscious awareness level of the followers. Now, that means that to be able to do that, the leader needs to be informed. I'll never forget a meeting that I had in 1979 with the then Vice President of the United States, Walter Mondale. We were talking about some of the issues of the day and some of the criticism that that administration was getting for their actions. And Mondale said something that was profound. He said, "Decision-making is easy when you don't have all the information." What he was saying is those people who are most critical of a leader's decisions are usually those people who are least well-informed. Now, let me reconcile that with what I said earlier. Incomplete information is often sufficient to make a decision, but that's not an excuse for the high-impact leader to be uninformed. When the high-impact leader is informed, they can, number one, leverage those problems into the awareness level of followers, and then, number two, they've got an option. Either make the followers so uncomfortable that they address the problem, or make the problem so interesting that it can't be ignored. You see, that's the key. Either make the problem so uncomfortable that it can't be ignored, or make it so interesting that people will want to tackle it. Now, keep in mind that managers are problem solvers, but leaders teach others to solve their own problems. Now, there's a higher evolutionary phase than simply being a problem solver. And that is that managers, if they're lucky, notice opportunities that exist around them, but leaders exploit those opportunities. Peter Drucker, in his book Innovation and Entrepreneurship, said one of the great problems in American business is that we are so focused on our problems that we miss the opportunities all around us in the marketplace. Pogo, the famous comic strip philosopher, once said, "Gentlemen, we are surrounded by insurmountable opportunities. It is the job of the leader not only to recognize those opportunities, but to exploit them." Now, exploitation is negative when it's done to people. However, it's perfectly all right to exploit opportunities, because to exploit means to seize and take advantage of. You see, the high-impact leader teaches people to solve problems and then recognizes and helps people exploit the opportunities that exist in the workplace. The third skill to high-impact leadership is visioning, becoming an architect of the future. The fourth skill of high-impact leadership is persuasive communication. Here's another leadership axiom. Managers tell people what to do. Leaders explain why it should be done. You see, the leader is meaning maker. They need not only to tell people what needs to be done, but they need to be able to sell them on the need for doing it. You see, there's a difference between impressing and influencing people. I spent many years in sales before I started training full-time, and one of the things I learned is that the impressive salesperson is usually the poor salesperson. Because an impressive salesperson leaves the customer's office, the customer has been impressed with the salesperson, their product, their service, their company, but the problem is they didn't buy anything. You see, impressing people is a lot like creativity. It's a head game. The successful salesperson, the persuasive communicator, is an influencer, because influencing people is a behavior game. Influencing people begins with changing the way that people think and then getting them to take action on that new information. Let me begin by explaining some of the keys to being a persuasive communicator. First, you have to realize as a leader that the people who look up to you and follow you only buy two things: solutions to problems and good feelings. If we are going to be high-impact leaders, we've got to do a good job at providing people with both. Now, if you've ever been through any kind of sales training, you've probably heard the phrases before. People don't buy drills, they buy holes. People do not buy cars, they buy transportation and status. Of course, my favorite, people do not buy cosmetics, they buy hope. The question today isn't what do you sell as a high-impact leader, but whether or not it addresses the needs of the people who follow you. And the needs that they have are, number one, solutions to the problems facing them personally and organizationally, and number two, feeling good about their interaction with you. We call that relationship management. One of the most powerful skills of high-impact leadership is managing the relationships you have with followers, with coworkers, with the people that you work for, and the people that you do business with in the marketplace. You see, before you can be persuasive as a communicator, you've got to understand what it is that people buy. Next, let me tell you about the most important sale you'll ever make. Let me tell you about the toughest person to persuade. In the 1940s, there was a diamond merchant in New York City named Harry Winston. Harry Winston had a very large and expensive diamond in his collection that only a few collectors in the world could afford to own. So he sent out some personal invitations to invite some of these collectors to view the diamond. A man flew in from the Netherlands. Winston arranged to have his best diamond salesperson show the man the diamond. The diamond salesperson talked about the quality of the diamond's cuts. He talked about the potential for appreciation. He talked about the rarity of the diamond in the international marketplace. But within 10 minutes, the man said, "No, thank you," and started to leave the store. Winston saw him leaving the store, and he says, "Excuse me, sir, but before you leave, do you mind if I personally show you the diamond?" The man looked at his watch. He said, "No, I've come a long way. I suppose it would be all right to look at it again." Winston takes the diamond out. Winston doesn't talk about the technical qualities of the diamond. Winston talks about its exquisite beauty and the pleasure that it brings to the people who view it. Within about 10 minutes, the man is writing out a check for the full value of the diamond. Doesn't even try to negotiate with Winston. As he's writing out the check, he says, "Mr. Winston, I don't understand. 10 minutes ago, I was ready to leave the store. I was totally disinterested in the diamond. You showed it to me, and now I'm buying it from you. Why is that?" Winston said, "Well, you know, the diamond person who showed you the diamond first, they are the most knowledgeable salesperson I have in the store. They know more about diamonds than anyone else in our industry. But I would gladly double their salary if I could give them something that I possess. You see, they know diamonds, but me, I love diamonds. The most important sale you will ever make is being sold yourself. The most important sale you'll ever make isn't selling your coworker, your employee, your spouse, your kids, or a friend. It's being sold yourself. Because only when you have that passion and the commitment of a Harry Winston or a Joyce Meskis who loves her work at the Tattered Cover, only then can you truly persuade and convince others." Another key, once you have the power of persuasion that comes from being sold yourself, is what I call the power of positive discontent. The power of positive discontent is something that high-impact leaders can use to change people and to move them forward. You see, I was at the Ohio State University during the Woody Hayes years. Woody Hayes, the famous and in some cases infamous coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes football team. When I was at Ohio State, Woody Hayes used to say something that at the time I thought was football hype. He used to say, "You're either getting better or you're getting worse." I didn't believe it then, but years later, I finally understand what he meant. You see, in a real competitive world, the status quo is a myth. Because if you and I stay the same, the people around us continue to improve, and in a relative sense, we lose ground. We've got to make people uncomfortable with the status quo. High-impact leaders shake the cage in organizational America, making sure that people realize that the best isn't. Good enough never is. You see, if you tell enough people to make their job, their products, their services better, inevitably you will encounter those who say, "Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it." To those people, the high-impact leader says, "If it ain't broke, make it better anyhow." See, that's the power of positive discontent. And I've got to tell you that it's probably the most distasteful part of leadership, realizing that you can never be content. Now, it's okay to be proud of your past accomplishments, but never be content with what you've accomplished, because on the day you become content, you become complacent. And complacency is the number one killer of excellence in America today. You see, persuasive communicators shake the cage and harness the power of positive discontent in the workplace. I once heard someone define tact and diplomacy as the ability to tell somebody to go to Hades and make them look forward to the trip. One of the skills that leaders learn is the skill of tact and diplomacy. You see, I discovered a long time ago that you can't always tell people what they want to hear, but you can always tell them in such a way that they'll be willing to listen. And that's the key to tact and diplomacy. You see, the kind of leadership we need in America and the world are those leaders who are brave enough to tell us not what we want to hear, but what we need to hear. And the way that leaders do that is by focusing on the issues so they can be tough on the issues but soft on the people. So that they can be tough on the stand that they take but soft on the people who support them in that stand. That's what tact and diplomacy is all about. Once you have these skills of persuasion, knowing what it is that your followers buy, being sold yourself, harnessing the power of discontent, and being able to communicate tactfully and diplomatically, what are the tools that the high-impact leader uses to communicate? The single most important tool is storytelling. You see, storytelling makes the intangible tangible. And the reason why storytelling works is that, number one, it gets people to commit to people and values rather than facts and statistics. Number two, storytelling is a way of giving people examples, or what I call mental coat pegs, to hang examples on. Aristotle once said, "The mind never thinks without a picture." And so this vivid imagery, making the intangible tangible, is what storytelling is all about. Storytelling is accomplished a couple of ways. The first is through the use of analogy. Now, analogies are figurative language. It's using two things that are otherwise unlike to make a point. One of my friends in the speaking profession, a woman named Reva Nelson, once used a very descriptive analogy to describe what it's like trying to get started in professional speaking, and I suppose in that matter for any career. She said, "I've always felt that a career in speaking was like an airplane trying to take off. That initially it takes a great deal of power and energy just to get the airplane moving a little bit. But that over time it takes not less power, but the same amount of power to move the airplane faster and faster until it picks up speed. And then at some point, and you're not exactly sure when, the airplane is airborne." Descriptive way of explaining how difficult it is to get started in any craft or any profession. But there's another tool that I really like, and it's called the metaphor. The metaphor is using what people already understand to help them understand what they don't understand. Now, one of the great communicators in history was, of course, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ found a group of laborers, fishermen, and he didn't say to these people, "If you follow me, I'll teach you how to fundraise and recruit. I'll teach you the principles of psychology and how to persuade people." Instead, he said very simply, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," using what they already understood, fishing, to convey an important message about what he wanted to teach them to do. That's the power of the metaphor. Now, of course, before figurative language like metaphors and analogy, before storytelling can work when you're communicating with a listener, you've got to remember to break preoccupation. All listeners, all employees, all followers are preoccupied with the circumstances of their own life. Keep in mind that whenever you're communicating with someone, you can assume that that morning they found out that their son or daughter was failing math, they had a fight with their spouse, and the dog threw up on the carpet. And despite the fact that they are physically present and supposedly listening to you, they are preoccupied with the challenges and the harsh realities of their life. The famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright was asked to speak in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania many years ago. He began his speech by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is the ugliest city that I have ever seen." He captured the audience's attention, and he held the attention for the rest of his speech. Let me give you 5 specific techniques for breaking preoccupation when you communicate. The first is to begin with a challenge. "I challenge you to decrease overhead by 50% this fiscal year." "I challenge you to improve your productivity by 25% in the coming quarter." You see, that gets people's attention because the challenge creates a sense of responsibility. Number 2 are questions. Rhetorical questions or practical questions like, "What would happen if we lost our largest account? What will happen if the economy takes a sudden downturn? What will happen if we can no longer purchase petroleum inexpensively?" The third technique is to begin with a statistic, some kind of a shocking statistic or an illustration that gets people into the frame of reference that you want them to think in. Number 4 is some kind of personal disclosure. One of my favorites would be to begin by saying, "This may well be the most important speech I've ever made." Of course, the problem with that technique is that you can only use it once. But personal disclosure is a way to draw people in. And finally, number 5 is a news item of relevance. Several weeks ago, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and I found an excerpt that if I were in the automobile industry, I would have loved to use in a speech. Because the Wall Street Journal says, "The good news is the automobile industry is alive and well. The bad news is the Japanese own it." What a great way to begin a speech to rally people in the automobile industry to be more productive and to produce products of higher quality. Once you've gotten their attention, and keeping in mind that you're going to use stories to communicate your message, let me give you a checklist of the 3 ingredients that any communicator includes to make their presentation persuasive and convincing. Now, this comes from the study of ancient Greek. The Greeks spent a good amount of time to this whole idea of persuasion, and they found that the leader in the communicated message must include these 3 elements. The first element is ethos. Ethos is character, credibility, and rapport. You see, before we can convince another person to see things our way or to buy into our viewpoint, they have to respect us and they have to trust us. Now, rapport, which is a French word, means to feel comfortable or at ease with another human being. One of the tough jobs of high-impact leadership is to maintain a role model and yet be approachable and able to connect with people on their own level. When I was representing an organization in the late 70s and traveling a lot to speak, I found that what I said from the platform was less effective in establishing rapport than the fact that I would willingly help set up chairs or tear down the room after I spoke. because that let people know that I was a part of the group, not above the group. Before you can communicate persuasively, you've got to begin with ethos. Ethos is character, credibility, and rapport. The next ingredient is called logos. Logos is reason. Logos is telling people information that makes sense to them. And the third ingredient is pathos, and pathos is emotion. Because the persuasive communicator has to get people's passions, their emotions, running in the direction of what it is that they want them to do. Now, as you think about pathos, which is emotion, and logos, which is reason, remember that the majority of time, people decide to do things on the basis of pathos, which is emotion, but then must be able to justify their decision with logos, which is logic. Too often when we communicate, we either try to be too logical or too emotional. What we have to remember to do is to balance those two ingredients so that people can decide on an emotional level, but use logical information to validate that emotional decision that they've made. You know, we live in a very complicated world, and when we communicate, we have to remember something that was once shared by the director of a large securities exchange firm on the West Coast. He said, people want to be sold. They want somebody to say, this is what you should do. One of the paradoxes in society today is that people expect more options and more choices, but that in expecting more options and choices, they also expect an expert to guide them in their choices. Leadership is responsible for not just generating options for people, but directing them on which options are best for them. You see, that's the power of expertise. I call it decomplicating the world. Decomplicating the world means choosing one or two courses of action to present to people rather than telling them the myriad of ways that are available to them. Next, after you've given people some guidance and direction, you've got to create a sense of urgency. You're probably all familiar with Parkinson's Law. Parkinson's Law says work expands to fill the time allotted to it. You see, the leader has to create an immediate sense of what I call legitimate urgency. Because if they don't, what they'll find is that people have no real compulsion to be accountable in time. Accountable in time means that we are evaluating people not just on what they get done, but on how long it takes them to do it. Very often that means that we have to be able to create this legitimate sense of urgency from what would otherwise be taken as something that isn't particularly urgent. And finally, the last step in persuasive communication is a request for action. I call it what's next thinking. After every conversation, after every encounter, after every meeting, end by asking the person that you're communicating with, what's next? Always ask them to identify the next course of action that they are going to take that will move them or the organization closer to the objective, the goal, or the vision. Many people are familiar that when John F. Kennedy made his inaugural address, he said, "My fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." They don't remember his next statement, however, and that was an appeal to take action to the world. He said, "My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man." You see, John F. Kennedy ended his inaugural address with a request for action. To be a persuasive communicator means understanding the principles of persuasion, using stories as a way of making the intangible tangible, being tactful and diplomatic, creating a sense of urgency for people, directing them on the choices to make, and finally, moving them to the next step by using what's next thinking to focus them on the action that they're going to take. What I want to talk about in this section is how to move people. And the focus is on the skill of empowerment. And empowerment is understanding, enabling, and encouraging followers. The Center for Creative Leadership has found that the number one reason why executives are derailed in their career is due to insensitivity to the people that they work with. The samurai used to have a maxim that said, if you understand not yourself, you will lose 100% of the time. If you understand yourself, you will win 50% of the time. But if you understand both yourself and your opponent, you will win 100% of the time. You see, the samurai believed that it was important to understand your opponent. Leaders believe that it's important to understand your allies. The first step in empowering people is taking time to get to know them and to understand them. Now, I was thinking about the difference between managing and leading, how to be more than a manager. And I suddenly realized that in all of the great religions of the world, in Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, and Islam, in none of those religions is there a commandment that says, we are to like one another. There's no instruction to like your neighbor as yourself. And yet the common theme in all of the world's great religions is a central commandment that says we should love one another, that we should love our neighbor. Now, this isn't just semantical. There's a difference between like and love. I hope that today, if you are a leader, that you like the people you lead. Because if you don't, remove yourself from a leadership position. Life is too short to lead people that you don't like or who don't like you. But you know, no matter how much you like your people, no matter how much they like you, there's going to be some days that they'd like to strangle you. There's going to be some days that figuratively you'd like to murder them. There's something more important than liking people. You see, managers can usually like their people, but leaders love their people. The difference between like and love is this. You see, like is an emotion and emotions change, but love is a commitment and commitments last. You see, what's more important than liking people is loving people. And I'm not talking about that sugary sweet emotion that we usually associate with the word love. I'm talking about a choice to treat people with dignity and respect even when they don't deserve it, and even when you don't feel like it. You see, that's what I call commitment-based leadership. Maybe you've worked for a manager who is an emotional cripple. They let their emotions drag them through life. When they're in a good mood, they're wonderful human beings, but when they're not, there's havoc to pay. Well, I'm not talking about that. One of the earliest lessons I can recall from my own career was working as an account executive in a publishing firm in Wisconsin. I had been on the job only for a couple of weeks when I made my first important client call. It was to Peterbilt Trucks in Milwaukee, one of the largest truck dealerships in the Midwest. And I went to this meeting with the president of the company and the director of marketing. Now, the president of the company was a very wealthy man. He had been brought in to effect a turnaround within the organization. At one time, he had been a colleague of Tom Peters and Bob Waterman at McKinsey Company, the consulting firm. Very successful, very wealthy, and at the time, that's what impressed me about him. But after my first client meeting, I was impressed for a different reason. You see, the president made introductions at the meeting. He began by introducing the director of marketing, and then he came to me. Now, he could have said, I'd like you to meet our new employee, because I was the new employee. He could have said, I'd like you to meet my assistant, because in a way, I was his assistant. He could have even introduced me as the account executive. But he said none of those things. I can still remember standing there that day, he said, gentlemen, I'd like you to meet my associate. And at that moment, I remember thinking that I would walk over hot coals for this guy. Why? Because here I was, wet behind the ears, and he was treating me as a co-equal. You see, it's the little things we do that tip people off to how we really feel about them. You see, what's more important than liking people is loving people. Managers like the people they manage. Leaders love the people that they lead. If you really love your people, that means if you're really committed to them, it then becomes your objective as a leader to create value for them in every interaction. Whenever you do business in the marketplace of human affairs, whether it's with a follower, employee, whether it's with a coworker, whether it's with a customer, you will leave that person in one of three emotional conditions. First, if they got less than they expected from you, they feel cheated. Doesn't matter what you plan to provide them. The question is, what did they expect from the encounter? Number two, if you only give them what they expected, they feel satisfied. But you know, managers satisfy the people that they manage. My challenge to you today is whenever you interact with another human being, to leave them feeling delighted. And people who are delighted because they feel they have gotten more than they expected when they least expected it. To create value in the marketplace of human affairs, give people more than they expected when they least expected it. You know, every year at Christmas, I'm reminded that we send Christmas cards to our friends, our family members, and to our customers in the marketplace. And of course, they get thousands of cards from other friends and other vendors and other colleagues. So I started sending Thanksgiving cards. Each year, I send Thanksgiving cards to some of my favorite clients, to some of my best friends, and some of the special people in my life. Last year when I did that, I got three long-distance phone calls from people thanking me for the Thanksgiving card. Now, the card cost the same as a Christmas card. The stamp was the same as a stamp to send the card at Christmas time, but the difference was the timing. I was able to create value by doing something for people that they didn't expect when they least expected it. That's what I mean when I say empowerment is about, first of all, understanding people. And if you understand people and are committed to them, then it becomes your objective to create value for them. Why is that powerful in leadership? You see, when you create value for other people will create value for you. It's called the law of social reciprocity. The law of social reciprocity simply says an act of kindness creates an unspoken obligation for the other person to return that act of kindness. I was in a candy store just window shopping, and by the way, it's a bad idea to window shop in a candy store. Didn't plan to buy anything, but I was looking at some of the candies in the case when evidently the woman behind the counter noticed me drooling. I was looking at chocolate-covered macadamia nuts, which happened to be my favorite, and she came over and she said, "Would you like a chocolate-covered macadamia nut?" I said, "Well, no, not really." I said, "I'm not interested in buying any today. I'm just looking." And she said, "Here, have one on me. It's free." She handed me a chocolate-covered macadamia nut. I popped it in my mouth, and as I was chewing it, I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. What kind of human being would eat your candy for free and then leave your store without buying anything? That day, I bought a half pound of chocolate-covered macadamia nuts. Why? Because in giving me the free candy, she had created an unspoken obligation to return the favor. You see, that's the law of social reciprocity. Now, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not suggesting that we do things for people with an ulterior motive. I'm simply explaining that when we create value for other people, it creates the likelihood that they will likewise create value for us. That's what it means, number one, to understand the people that you lead. But number two, within empowerment, let's talk about what it takes to enable people. There are a number of techniques that you can use to enable the people who follow you. And the first I call values clarification. Values clarification is the first empowerment technique for high-impact leaders. I was driving from Cleveland, Ohio to Columbus, Ohio to do a seminar. Now, halfway in between, at the second Mansfield exit, nestled in the rolling hills of central Ohio, there was a McDonald's. I was starting to get a little bit groggy, falling asleep behind the wheel, so I decided to get off the interstate to get a cup of coffee to go. Now, I did not go through the drive-thru window because I had kind of an unusual request. I wanted to get a small cup of coffee in a large cup. Now, why would a guy ask for a small cup of coffee in a large cup? To provoke the person behind the counter? Because you know they've been having a good day and now you're going to mess it up for them. No, what was my motivation? Yeah, have you ever noticed you get a cup of coffee to go, they always fill the coffee cup up to the very brim. What you may not know is that that plastic lid is specially designed to be spring-loaded. So at 65 miles an hour, you end up with scalding hot liquid on your crotch. Not only is this potentially dangerous, it's painful. And I didn't want hot liquid on any part of my anatomy. I decided to take my request into the counter. I figure for drive-thru, this is a trick question. I go into the restaurant. I approach the person working behind the counter. Now, I am assuming that they're a part-time employee. This is probably a high school or a college student. I said, "Ma'am, I would like a small cup of coffee in a large cup." She said, "I don't know if I can do that." I said, "Well, it's really very easy. Just hold the cup and pour it till it's about half full." She goes, "No, I'm not sure I'm allowed. I'll have to ask." Now, at exactly this moment, the manager of the restaurant is walking by. Now, I don't have to make any of these stories up. My life is far more bizarre than my imagination has created. She turns to the manager of the restaurant. She says, "Excuse me." She said, "This customer would like a small cup of coffee in a large cup." Manager doesn't look up. He doesn't even slow down. He simply says, "Then charge him for a full cup." And he keeps on going. Now, if you were to ask the manager of that particular restaurant what he had been hired to do, what do you think he'd tell you? Well, to ride herd on the kids that work there. See, if we're going to make money, I've got to make sure that the employees don't make stupid mistakes. In the fast food business, we inventory coffee on the basis of cup size. The cup costs more than the coffee. If you give a guy a small cup of coffee in a large cup, you'll throw the system off by 3 or 4 cents. Of course, what he communicated to me is that my business wasn't worth a dime. That's the price difference between a large and a small cup of coffee. Let me suggest that his role should have been to clarify the values that shaped the employee's decision-making process. You see, Roy Disney put it eloquently when he said, "Decision-making is easy when values are clear." We can't create rule books and policies and procedures that will dictate how an employee acts or behaves on the job because there are too many unknowns, too many unforeseen circumstances. The best we can hope for in leadership is to clarify the values that shape the decision-making process for employees. Somewhere in Ohio, there should be a McDonald's franchise owner who does not sleep at night because they have a manager who is willing to throw away a customer over a dime. A manager who doesn't realize that the primary purpose of any for-profit business is to create and maintain customers. Because without customers, profitability is an impossibility. The first key to empowering and enabling people is values clarification. The second key is a topic we don't talk about very much. The topic is trust. One of the most common questions I get asked by managers and leaders in seminars is, "How do I get people to trust me?" You're probably not going to like my response, but very simply, to be trusted, be trustworthy. How is it that an employee knows that they are trusted? How is it that an employee evaluates their leader to be trustworthy? Basically, through three means. First of all, employees know they are trusted when a manager or leader delegates to them. You want to know one of the reasons why leaders in America don't have time to lead? It's because they're too busy doing the work that followers should be doing. Now, managers delegate responsibilities, but leaders delegate authority. Responsibility means being able to respond with ability. But you and I cannot respond with ability, nor can the people we lead, unless we have given them authority. And authority is the power to act independently, to make judgment calls, to make their own decisions, to try things their own way. The first step in creating trust between leader and follower is to delegate not just the responsibility, but the authority. The second skill is to listen. You see, one of the biggest dangers in America today is thinking we know what someone wants or needs without asking them. You see, the danger is in thinking that as an expert or an authority, we know better than the people we lead. The danger is that we will do things for them that they do not want to have done for them. We've got to listen, because employees say that those managers who listen to them, they believe, trust them. And finally, if you want to empower people through trust, become a champion. A champion is a leader who will go to the wall for their followers so their followers don't have to. A champion is a leader who will put themselves at risk so the people who follow them don't have to put themselves at risk. You see, business leaders in America today have to remember that there are actually two jobs that they've got. The first is to represent the needs of the organization to the followers. But the second is to represent the needs of the followers to the organization. If you want to be trusted as a leader, be trustworthy. If you want to prove to the people who follow you, your employees, that you trust them, make sure that you delegate, that you listen, and that you are their champion. Here's the third key to empowerment. Involvement creates commitment. Ownership obligates. Let me give you four questions that you can ask the people who you lead to keep them involved in the work of the organization, to keep them involved in the vision. The first question, what have you learned this week? Earlier we said that introspection was important for self-mastery. If it's important to the leader, it should be important to followers. So on a regular basis, ask the people who follow you, question number one, what have you learned this week? Question number two, what do you think? Encourage dissension. Do you know that if the other people who you lead think exactly the way that you think, somebody isn't necessary? Samuel Goldwyn once said, I want people who will disagree with me even if it costs them their job. Now my guess is Samuel Goldwyn didn't get many people that disagreed with him, but the intent was there, and that is to encourage dissension makes for better decision making. So number two, if you want people to know that you not only trust them, but that you value their input, ask them, what do you think about this situation? What do you think about this project? Number three, how do you feel about what happened? You know, managers try to win the minds of the people they manage. Leaders try to win their minds and their hearts. So we need to spend some time finding out not just what people did, but how they feel about what they did, how they feel about what happened. And finally, number four, when there's a conflict or a problem, when you have yourself in a position to be disciplinarian and it's difficult, ask that person who you must discipline, what would you do if you were in my shoes? To create empathy for your situation, to involve them in choosing a course of action that is fair, ask them, what would you do if you were in my shoes? Collaboration creates commitment. Next, I challenge you to create accountability. Let me give you one question that you must ask every employee every quarter. If you want to keep people accountable, the question is, what have you done in the past quarter to add value to this organization? You see, it's not enough to simply fulfill your job description. It's not enough to simply carry out instructions. I want self-starters, people who are motivated and take the initiative to add value. So the question of accountability, what have you done to add value to the organization? Empowerment means, number one, understanding the people you lead. Number two, it means enabling them. And here's the third component. Finally, it means encouraging people. Little Jimmy came home from school, 10-year-old kid. He says to his mom, he says, I've got a girlfriend. Now, Jimmy never had a girlfriend before. His mom says, well, what is it that she likes about you? He says, she thinks I'm cute, have a good sense of humor, and that I'm a great dancer. She said, what is it that you like about her? He said, the fact she thinks I'm cute, have a good sense of humor, and that I'm a great dancer. See, we respond positively to people who make us feel good about ourselves. We like people who like us. We appreciate people who appreciate us. You see, the last step in empowerment is appreciating, recognizing, and encouraging the people that you lead. Managers try to be heroes. Leaders try to make heroes. You know what leaders have found? Leaders have found that when you focus the spotlight on your followers, the reflection on you is even brighter. Leaders have found that where you give credit where credit is due, more credit goes to the leader who was the catalyst for making it happen. Sam Preston retired from SC Johnson Wax after many years of service as an executive vice president. While he was at Johnson Wax, he used to make it a point to send handwritten notes. When he caught somebody doing something worthwhile, something that merited recognition, he would scrawl DWD across the top and then send them a note, "Congratulations on a job well done." The DWD stood for damned well done. When he retired, they had a retirement party for him, and he was amazed that people lined up, clutching wrinkled yellow pieces of paper, 15 years old, across the top was scrawled DWD. You see, that little act of recognition and appreciation meant a lot to the people that he did it for. An insignificant act with a significant outcome. It's important for people to feel appreciated. But even more important is for people to know that there is someone who believes in them so much that they will not let them be less than they could be. After teaching in the Chicago public school systems for 14 years, Marva Collins retired, so to speak, and she purchased a three-story building in a bad part of Chicago, and she opened a school known as Westside Preparatory School. She wanted to prove that you could take students who had failed by the system standards and turn them into achievers. Well, she was so successful in the years that followed that 60 Minutes featured her on their television show. They even made a TV movie about Westside Prep. What's been the secret of Marva Collins' success? She says very early on, as she was discouraged with the handicaps and the learning disabilities of these underprivileged minority children, she realized that failing was not an option. And she made it a point to communicate on the first day of class to every student, "I will not let you fail." Her success has been through the power of encouragement. And today, if you were to visit Westside Preparatory School, you would find grade school children reading the classics and performing at grade levels significantly higher than the grade that they're at. See, that's the power of encouragement. The fifth skill of high-impact leadership, to be more than a manager, means empowering people. You empower people through understanding, through enabling them to act, and through encouragement. The sixth and final skill of leadership, of course, is what I call service, fulfillment through contribution. Max Dupree is the chairman of the board and CEO of Herman Miller, a maker of fine office furniture. He says, the first act of leadership is to define reality. The last act is to say thank you. In between, the leader is servant. One of the questions of contemporary leadership today is, of course, what motivates the leader? Let me tell you everything I know about human motivation in one sentence. Everyone has a passion for significance. I've never met anybody that wakes up in the morning and wants to spend 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day doing something that doesn't count. What I believe motivates the leader is a passion for significance in their organization and in the lives of the people that they live and work with. But you see, we forget that as leaders, as people on this planet, that we don't always control what happens to us. As a matter of fact, when something unfortunate happens, we have a phrase for it. We call it being a victim of circumstance. Two of the most delightful people that I've had a chance to meet in my life are Norm and Phyllis Lawson. The perfect couple. Norm is the vice president of sales for an ice cream company, Dreyer's Ice Cream, who I mentioned earlier. He's got a job everybody would like to have. He sells ice cream. He's married to a beautiful wife. He's financially secure and independent. His hobby is racing vintage automobiles. He had a 20-year-old daughter who was a beautiful daughter and a child that he loved very much. But you see, despite that seemingly perfect life that Norm and Phyllis Lawson had, 7 years ago, something happened that changed their life forever. Driving home from Arizona State one summer, Lori Lynn Lawson, Norm and Phyllis's daughter, crashed her car. They don't know exactly what happened. They don't know if she fell asleep at the wheel or if she just drove off the road for a moment. But a friend who was driving in front of her looked in the rearview mirror in time to see the car tumbling end over end. She was thrown from the automobile and killed. Now, I don't know what could possibly have caused that turn of events in their lives, but certainly most of us would agree that for two parents to lose their only child, they certainly must be victims of circumstance. For the next several years, they started to work through that grieving process of incredible loss. Norm started to run with a group of 25 men every Saturday morning from his church. He said everybody in the group had a problem, either financial or physical or job-related. And he said, we all learned to solve our problems by helping each other solve theirs. 10 months after Lori was killed in the automobile accident, the youth pastor of their church called Norm and Phyllis and said, I'd like to ask you to do me a favor. There's a new couple in the community. This past weekend, their two sons were driving up to ski. They were both killed in an automobile accident. I'd like you to counsel with them. I'd like you to encourage them. Norm and Phyllis said they went to this couple, and their intention, of course, was to help them. But they said an amazing thing happened. In trying to help the couple deal with the couple's loss, the couple helped them deal with their loss. You know what Norm and Phyllis Lawson learned? To be comforted, comfort others. Today, they spend a great deal of time talking with and counseling and sending letters and cards and notes of encouragement to other adults who have lost children, just like they have. You see, they have found that their fulfillment is through service to other people, that their fulfillment is through the contribution that they make. See, Norm and Phyllis Lawson are not victims of circumstance. They are victors of circumstance. You see, you can't always control what happens to you in life, but you can always control how you respond to the event. That's what it means to be a victor of circumstance. And when I think of victors of circumstance, some of the most courageous leaders I know, I think of Sharon Monsky, MBA from Stanford University, successful entrepreneur. And in 1982, she was diagnosed as having scleroderma. Scleroderma is a disease of the connective tissue. It usually claims the lives of its victims within 7 years. But in 1986, Sharon Monsky started the Scleroderma Research Foundation because, you see, it's such a rare disease that very little money had ever been spent in looking for a cure. And even though she never expected to live to benefit from her efforts, she became a victor of circumstance by starting the Scleroderma Research Foundation. Can't always control what happens to you as a leader, but the most important question is not what happened, but how did you respond to what happened? Did you choose to be a victim or to be a victor of circumstance? There is an Indian proverb that says, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrow it from our grandchildren. You see, I believe one of the overlooked aspects of leadership today is that with leadership comes the awesome responsibility of stewardship and of service and of contribution. It is possible for leaders working through their organizations to make a positive difference in their communities, in their countries, in their planet. Jack McAllister is the chief executive officer of U.S. West, a $9 billion telecommunications giant. And yet, despite his busy schedule, 75 to 80% of Jack McAllister's time is spent giving speeches and working on two issues of critical importance to him, homelessness and education. You see, Jack McAllister has learned that doing good and doing business go hand in hand. For instance, under Jack McAllister's leadership, they have started Osage Initiatives. It was a building donated by U.S. West, along with a loan of $2.8 million and a $300,000 gift. And at Osage Initiatives, they make available job training, food, shelter, and clothing for homeless people to become productive members of society. But you see, it's not a handout, it's a partnership, because the people that work at Osage Initiatives then provide quality labor for U.S. West and some of the other businesses in the area. You see, Jack McAllister believes that creating a healthy business environment in the community is not only good for the people, but good for the business. U.S. West is committed to spending $20 million over the next 4 or 5 years to recognize outstanding teachers within their 14-state service region, because they believe the quality of the education that their future employees are receiving today will affect the quality of how they do business in the future. You see, McAllister believes that with the responsibility of economic power comes the responsibility of stewardship. Bonnie Reese was an entertainment lawyer in Los Angeles, very successful. She started reading about needles washing up on beaches. She started reading about rainforest being depleted at the rate of one football field's worth of rainforest every 3 seconds. She quit her job and she founded Earth Communications Organization. She now mobilizes entertainers in the theater and in art and in TV, because she says, if we only have 10 years left on this planet and there are 5 billion people, obviously we don't have time to go door to door. You see, she's finding fulfillment through contribution. The debt is not simply to take from the system, but to repay the debt, to put something back into the system. And I think what's very frustrating in America today, what's very frustrating in the world today, is that you and I, as high-impact leaders, realize that we're not going to leave the seminar and change everything. The tragedy, of course, is that we might leave the seminar and change nothing. You and I probably realize that we're not going to leave the seminar today and help everybody in our organizations, but the tragedy will be if you leave the seminar and you don't help somebody. You see, the message of leadership is change something, help somebody. Martin Luther King said before his career was tragically ended, he said, the greatest tragedy of our social transition is not the noisiness of the so-called bad people. It is the appalling silence of the so-called good people. I was doing a program in Houston, Texas, and a woman came up at the end of the day, and she was very kind, very flattering. And she said, Mark, I really agreed with everything you said today. I personally feel the same way that you feel, but I've just got one question. When do you think it's all going to change? And I said to her in Houston, Texas, something that I've shared with as many audiences as I could ever since. I said, I am convinced that it will change for our organizations, for our communities, and possibly even for our planet when people just like you and me make it change. A horse is galloping swiftly down the side of the road, and an old farmer standing in the field yells out. He says, "Hey, rider, where are you going?" The rider turns and shouts back, "Don't ask me, just ask my horse." You know, when you look at the world around us, the circumstances and the challenges that we face, you might come to the conclusion that we are all riding horses that are galloping wildly out of control. We may ask ourselves, where are we going organizationally? Where are we going personally? Of course, the premise of high-impact leadership is that leaders are those people who respond to the challenge, who take up the reins and set the course, both for themselves and for their organizations. I believe there are some deadly assumptions that managers make. What I'd like to do with you today is share with you some of those deadly assumptions and then offer the realities that high-impact leaders operate in. One of my observations about the companies that I train for is that many employees are so busy trying to survive organizationally that they have no time to contribute to the bottom line. What we typically do is we look to see what the people in leadership or management are doing. We then try to emulate them, assuming that if those behaviors have made them successful, those same behaviors will make us successful. What this results in some organizations is what I call perpetuation of stupidity. If we have poor role models who are directly above us or who are in upper management, we will begin to emulate those poor behaviors, and those behaviors perpetuate themselves over time. Some of these poor behaviors come to us because of assumptions that managers hold. And the first will probably sound familiar. It is the assumption that today customer service is the strategic edge. In reality, it is not customer service that is the strategic edge, but rather service. Now, there's an important difference. I believe that one of the reasons we are in trouble organizationally is that we have lost all sense of the service ethic. As a matter of fact, the phrase customer service suggests that unless somebody is a customer, they do not deserve to be served. Therefore, we find that we are not tuned in to serving coworkers, to serving employees, to serving managers, to serving vendors, or simply serving the people that we live with each day. And this loss of the service ethic has translated all the way through to the customer. Lacking good role models and lacking a sense of service, we find that the new emphasis is on serving the customer better, suggesting that only those people who pay should be served. Bob Dylan was prophetic over 10 years ago when he wrote a song called "Everybody's Gotta Serve Somebody." You see, I believe that service is the heart of high-impact leadership. Those people who lead best are simply those people who have a desire to serve, not just the customer, but the people that they come in contact with each day. Recently, I was in Hong Kong on business. I decided to take a ferry out to the island of Lama. Lama is about a 40-minute ferry ride. It is a fairly sparsely populated island. There are two places to dock, and at one set of docks, there are a number of restaurants. That is pretty much all the commerce on the island of Lama. It is a tourist island, and the people that live there live in fairly minimal conditions. I docked at the port where the restaurants were and decided before I would eat lunch that I would walk across the ridge that separated the two sides of the island. And I underestimated both the heat and the humidity and the distance. When I finally arrived to the other side, the first establishment that I came to was a hotel called the Concerto Inn. Now, the Concerto Inn was probably more like what you and I in the United States would call a bed and breakfast. But as I approached The proprietor of the hotel, a woman named May Tan, came out, and she apologized immediately that if I had come for lunch, she would be unable to accommodate me because of some equipment failure that they were experiencing. I said, well, I really don't care to eat, but a cold beer would certainly be nice. She said that the cooler was in good working order, and she brought me a cold beer. I said, when I walk back to the other side of the island, I would like to eat lunch by the docks. What restaurant would you recommend? She said that she wasn't on that side of the island very much, that she didn't know a good restaurant, but that she would find out. She disappeared for a few minutes, made some phone calls, checked with some friends, and came back with several good restaurant recommendations. I then asked her if she knew what time the ferry left that went back to Hong Kong. She said, not only can I tell you when the ferry leaves, I can give you a schedule. You see, she had printed on the back of her business card the schedule for the ferry arrivals and departures. Well, I talked to her for a while about what she did at the Concerto Inn. She and her husband had remodeled this and turned it into a very elegant, very nice place for tourists to stay. And before I decided to depart, she said, listen, I notice you've got a water bottle with you. Can I fill the water bottle before you leave? Now, what is interesting to me is that this example of service in micro is an example that most organizations, most hotels in the United States would love to emulate. Because you see, May Tan had the heart of service. She didn't view me as a customer. As a matter of fact, I couldn't be a customer because she couldn't have served lunch that day had she wanted to. But because of that orientation towards service, it translated itself not only in the way that she treated me, but I'm sure in the way she treated her employees and the people that she did business with. To challenge this assumption that customer service is the strategic edge, I'd like to suggest that the people we should be focused on serving in any organization, whether we are employees or leaders, are the people at the next step in the process. Whether you're involved in the delivery of a product or a service, you have to ask yourself, who is it that I have been hired to serve? As Tom Peters and some of the other great management thinkers today have suggested, I believe that the most important phrase in business is the phrase relationship building, and that the heart of service is what drives that relationship building. The fastest growing company in American business history is a company called Connor Peripherals. Connor Peripherals manufactures in Singapore. They have a plant with about 7,500 employees. H.B. Chan is the managing director of the manufacturing plant in Singapore. In 1987, he hired his management team. He has made it a point each year to take his management team on a holiday of sorts outside of Singapore. And he says that although they do some business, the primary purpose of their trip is purely to have fun and get to know each other better. What's fascinating is that since 1987, H.B. Chan has not lost a single manager that he hired. He has proven that that soft skill of relationship building translates to the bottom line when we realize that customer service isn't the objective. The real objective is to better serve the people that we live and work with. And service is the heart of high-impact leadership. Here's another assumption that flies in the face of contemporary business management wisdom. The assumption is we're smarter than our customers. I call it the trap of the expert. We think because we are in a particular business, we know what it is that our customers want or need better than they do. Here is the important reality. Our customers are at least as smart as us, but together, we're smarter than either of us. Now, I'm not sure how grammatically correct that is, but the concept is important to remember. There is a certain synergy that occurs when we combine what we know about our product or service, our expertise, with what the customer wants and needs. For several years, I've been telling the story of Texonic, which is a manufacturing firm that makes depth finders for fishermen. Up until 1985, they had had numerous product failures in the marketplace. They decided if they were going to build a good depth finder, they probably ought to ask the people that use it. They put together 26 groups of users across the United States and got feedback on what makes for a good depth finder. One of the things that the fishermen suggested was that they wanted an LCD readout that could be read in bright sunlight. If you're in the middle of a river or a lake, the sun is very bright, it's difficult to read the digital readout on a typical depth finder. Well, they took these ideas from the fishermen, from the users, and incorporated them into their new product, which was called the Hummingbird. In the following 12 months, company revenues tripled to $80 million. Now, the motto at Texonic is, today, Quality and service are what the customer says they are. In an oversimplified view of the world, that's not bad advice, but I think we can do better than that. I believe that quality and service are what the customer say they are and what the supplier tells the customer they could be. You see, here's the problem that we face. Customer expectations have been shaped by past experience. That presents two problems. Number one, the people that we serve in the marketplace may not know what is possible. And that's particularly true when it comes to technology. Because we are experts in our field, we have a better grasp of how technology can affect the products and services we deliver. And that grasp is beyond the reach of the typical customer. The second problem is that a customer may not appreciate the benefits of new innovation. Therefore, we must educate them. You see, I think a more accurate view of the world is not to look at quality and service as being simply defined by the people we serve, whether it's internal in our organizations or external, but rather as a synergistic result of what occurs when we explain and educate the customer on what is possible and then find out from them, of those possibilities, what they really value. The next assumption is the assumption that people should conform to the system. The reality of high-impact leadership is that the system should almost always conform to the people. I'd like you to think about a chain. It's what I call the maker, system, end-user chain. The maker is the craftsperson who provides the product or service. The system is the tool or tools that they use. And of course, the objective is to satisfy, or perhaps even better, to delight the end-user. When a craftsperson uses a tool, they're using that tool to leverage their knowledge and their skill. It would be ludicrous to think that if the tool changed, that the craftsperson would have to adjust their knowledge and skill to the tool. Rather, progress is always dependent upon the tools conforming to help the craftsperson leverage that knowledge and skill into a product or service for the end user. Of course, the problem that happens is that organizationally we create systems. And when those systems do not work, if they do not support the people that work in the system, we demand that the people change. You know, in mental health, they believe that the first sign of mental illness is rigidity of thinking. I've come to believe that in organizational consulting, the first sign of organizational illness is rigidity of systems. Telling people that the systems are locked into place, that they cannot be changed or improved to better leverage the skills of the people that work there. Now, you can actually take this a step further and say, as Paul Hawken does, that one of the important concepts of service in the marketplace is making sure that your systems conform to the customer rather than your customer conforming to the systems. Paul Hawken, of course, is the entrepreneur in Mill Valley, California, the founder of Smith & Hawken Garden Tool Company, the author of the book Growing a Business. And Hawken says, when you treat every customer as an exception, your service will become exceptional. Again, a key concept in high-impact leadership is examining the systems that you have created organizationally and asking, do those systems truly leverage the knowledge and skills of our craftspeople, the people that make the products and services we provide? Here's an assumption. It would be amusing if it wasn't tragic. You can turn a mediocre new employee into a good employee with time. The reality is mediocre new employees usually turn into mediocre old employees. Why? Well, there are several reasons. The first is my belief that probably the weakest link in our chain of leadership in America today is poor recruiting and hiring. As I mentioned earlier, we are facing a labor shortage, fewer and fewer entry-level employees available each year from now to the end of the century. According to the Wall Street Journal, large companies are actively courting college students before they graduate in an effort to lock up the market on talent, making it very difficult for small to medium-sized companies to get the talent that was once available at the college level. After we spend very little time recruiting and hiring people, the second problem is they come on board with little or no coaching whatsoever. And that's a dangerous assumption that I'll talk about in just a moment. What we now have is someone who may be mediocre to begin with, given no coaching, no guidance, they stay mediocre, and after a certain period of time, we realize performance is substandard, no one has the guts to get rid of them. One of the key roles of high-impact leadership is surrounding ourselves with talent, and that begins at the recruiting and hiring phase. Of course, this assumption that you can turn a mediocre new employee into a good employee is linked to my next assumption, and that is the assumption that performance is achieved through osmosis. A friend of mine's wife recently went to work for a new employer. She has two college degrees. She was supposed to go through a two-day orientation program, and when she arrived the first day, she was informed that the person putting her through the orientation was ill. For the next 2 days, she sat behind a desk with absolutely nothing to do, no orientation taking place, learning nothing about the company. You see, what typically happens when we orient a new employee is we ask them to hang out with coworker Bob for anywhere from 2 to 5 days. Now, again, there are a number of problems with this approach to orienting employees. The first is, Bob isn't a trainer. It's interesting. We assume that if someone is competent at what they do, they can be competent at teaching other people how to do it. Simply not the case. The second problem we've got is that not only will Bob teach good habits, Bob will teach the bad habits that have developed over the years that he has been an employee there. And, of course, what I think is most dangerous, Bob will tell the new employee about the way it is instead of the way it should be. In other words, going back to my comment earlier, the perpetuation of stupidity will take place because Bob will take not only the good things that he has learned, but the bad things, and will inform the employee that that's the way that it's done there. Performance is not achieved through osmosis. Performance is achieved through coaching and practice. Probably the second greatest weakness in American business leadership is the lack of time devoted to coaching. You can immediately improve the performance of those people that you lead in your department or organization by, number one, devoting more time one-on-one, scheduling that time each month, and number two, spending time on skill development so that in the interim process between coaching, they'll have a chance to apply what they've learned. Here's another assumption. The assumption is that asking for help is a sign of weakness. The reality is not knowing when to ask for help is a sign of stupidity. There is a difference between independence and interdependence. Americans believe highly in the concept of independence, the self-made person. And yet independence has its limitations. Organizationally, what happens is we are unwilling to ask for help when we need it, or we are unwilling to offer help to those people we work with when they need it. The key for the future will be interdependence, which is shared dependency. Knowing that the strength in any team is the complementary skill set between leaders and followers. Surrounding yourself with the expertise that you yourself do not possess and being willing to offer your expertise to another person who might need it. Assumption: training is a luxury. The reality of the 90s is that training is a necessity. The root of the word education is educare, and educare literally means to lead. By the year 2000, 65% of companies with 10,000 plus employees will offer remedial education. Another crisis that we face today in America is that our educational system, for the most part, is falling short of training the people we work with for the skills that they will need to be successful organizationally. When I was speaking in Copenhagen, Denmark, a young manager came up to me at the break. He said that he attended many seminars and read some of the books that I had recommended, but that his boss was an old-style manager. His boss believed that attending seminars and reading books was a waste of time because it was time taken away from actually producing. I shared a story with this young manager that you probably have heard before, but it bears repeating and it bears retelling, especially if you're a leader. Two lumberjacks were arguing over who was better. They decided the only way to settle the dispute was to arise early the next morning. At sunup, they would begin chopping wood. At the end of the day, whoever had chopped the most wood would win. This they did. The first woodcutter was almost inhuman. He was able to work throughout the course of the day without stopping to eat or rest. He just broke occasionally to get something to drink. Now, the second woodcutter stopped every 2 to 2.5 hours. You can imagine at the end of the day how upset the first woodcutter was when the second woodcutter had been able to cut more wood. He said, "I don't understand. You were stopping every 2 or 3 hours to rest. I worked straight through the day. How could you possibly have produced more than me?" And of course, what the second woodcutter said was profound. He said, "Well, you see, I wasn't really stopping to rest. I was stopping to sharpen my axe." The irony is the busier that we become in our personal and professional lives, the more critically important it becomes that we stop periodically to sharpen our axe. I find that more and more leaders exert more and more energy and time and seem to be accomplishing less and less. The question might be, are you keeping your axe sharp through the necessity of continual training and education? The next assumption is that training is teaching people how to do what they already do better. The reality? Good training is about teaching people how to do what they aren't already doing. There is a difference between what we call adaptive and generative learning. Adaptive learning means learning how to solve the problems that confront you day to day. It's problem-solving skills as they relate to the workplace. Generative learning is about teaching people how to create and exploit opportunities. Historically, we have focused on adaptive learning, giving people only the skills they need to be successful at what they already do. But as we look at the challenges of the future, we realize that it will be critically important for people to move from simply solving problems to creating new opportunities and value for their employer. And finally, there is the assumption that a high-performing employee will make an effective manager. I've talked to too many disgruntled employees to believe that that is true. The reality is some of the best performers make some of the worst managers. I've seen this particularly in two areas, sales and technical areas. Take a salesperson who is very successful managing a territory or an account. Move them into management and you've immediately got two problems. The first is they will no longer have the time they enjoyed selling because now most of their time is taken up with managing other people's efforts to sell. And the second problem, of course, that you've got is that they may not have developed the skills of management. The skills that make for employee competency are not necessarily and usually aren't the skills that make for managerial competence. The same is true in technical professions. The skilled technician may lack those people skills that will make them a successful manager. And yet, why do so many competent employees get moved into management only to fail later? It is because of a belief on the part of the employee, based on the way the organization operates, that if they are going to move up and make more money, they must become managers. The best organizations today are creating dual career tracks for employees so that people can stay in their area of expertise and make more money by assuming more responsibility without necessarily managing other people. It would be interesting if we could quantify the loss of employee competence that occurs when we move people who are technically and competently skilled at what they do into management positions where they may or may not be suited. These are some of the deadly assumptions that managers make. As we know, high-impact leaders are more than managers, and they operate in new realities of the marketplace. Two of the most common questions that I get asked when talking about using values to motivate employees are, number one, can you give us some examples of what these values are? And number two, once we have clearly identified values organizationally, how can we use them? Well, if the most important concept for motivation is indeed the alignment of values, how can you use the answers to these two questions to better motivate and lead the people in your department? The staff of the Washington International Center has introduced thousands of international visitors to the United States for more than 30 years. The staff there looks at Americans through the eyes of their visitors, and they have found that there are 13 American values that generally differ from most of the other cultures in the world. Here are some of those values and how you can utilize them to motivate followers for high-impact leadership. The first is the value Americans possess that control over the environment is important, that personal control over the environment is empowering. You know, Americans have literally gone to the moon because they refused to accept earthly limitations. Americans respond positively to challenge. As a matter of fact, they are compelled to do what other people tell them can't be done. How can you use this value of personal control over the environment to challenge and motivate your people? Here are some ideas. First, give employees autonomy. Now, autonomy is the power to act independently. Recently, I was working with Enterprise Rent-A-Car, a very successful rental car franchise. They have been experiencing 20 to 25% growth per year for the past many years. And in some of their mature markets, they have over 50% market penetration. Now, their employees at Enterprise are relatively young, even at the managerial level. What is it that compels these young managers to excel? As I talked to many of them, they told me that what motivates them most is that they are given autonomy over their locations. They have clearly identified performance standards, but they are given free rein to manage in such a way as to achieve those results. What they found to be very empowering was this sense of personal control over what they did each day, the power of autonomy. The second thing you can do is challenge people with goals that cannot be easily achieved. We find that goal achievement is a continuum. At one end, we have goals that are too easy. And if a goal is easily achieved, why bother? At the other end, we have goals that are impossible to achieve. And if they're impossible to achieve, the question becomes, why try? The key is to challenge people by giving them goals that will not be easily achieved, but that are not impossible. And that, of course, compels them to put forth the effort. And finally, number three, look for ways to prove to people that what they do each and every day really does make a difference. I call these quick wins. We've got to prove to people that they still have control over their environment and that the little things they do each day really do count, and that those little things, these quick wins, creates a momentum that moves them closer to their long-range goals. What you can use to motivate your people is the value of change. You see, Americans see change as an indisputably good condition, a condition linked to the development and improvement of the organization or the person. They see change as linked to progress and growth. Now, of course, the interesting question is, if Americans value change, why then are people seemingly so averse to change? Well, this is an interesting paradox I'd like to explain. I believe there are two reasons why people resist change, even though they value it. The first is genetic. It's called laziness. You see, change means learning new skills, relearning the way we do things. And because we are basically lazy, we don't want to exert the effort that it takes to adapt to the change by learning the new skills that will be necessary to succeed. The second problem that makes people resistant to change is not the fear of change itself, but the fear of the process of change. Let me see if I can illustrate this. Many years ago, I had a roommate who was a writer for a magazine. His job required that he travel a great bit. The problem was he was deathly afraid of flying. Let's say that his boss gave him an assignment in Des Moines. At the time, he was living in Milwaukee. He was not afraid of Des Moines. You see, you might think of Des Moines in an analogy as the actual change, changing from his location in Milwaukee to Des Moines. What terrified him, however, was what would occur between Milwaukee and Des Moines, the process of traveling there, especially by airplane. You see, people do not fear the change itself. They fear the unknowns of the process of change. And this is important for leaders to remember if they want to get people to buy in to change in the organization. Let me explain what you can do. Basically, there are five steps to getting people to change. The first is probably the most overlooked, and that is make change a requirement. Very often, management will say to me, you know, for the last several years, we've been trying to get our people to change, and they refuse. And the first question I ask management is, why do they have a choice? You see, what we're talking about today is survival in the marketplace. Change cannot, must not be an option. I think we need to tell new employees, even before we hire them, that if they are going to work in our organization, change is a necessity, not a choice. It is not a question of will you change, it is simply a question of when will you change, and how will you change. The first step is to require change. The second step is to very clearly identify the outcome of the change, to paint people a very vivid picture of the destination so they know exactly where it is that they need to end up. Now, the third step addresses this fear of the process of change, and that is involve people in how the change will take place. I think one of the big mistakes we make is by mandating not only the change, but the process of change. Ironically, I was working with a Fortune 500 company that had decided to go to team-based manufacturing. Now, the whole premise of teamwork is employee involvement. The problem, of course, was the move to team-based manufacturing was made without any involvement whatsoever from the employees that would be affected. In other words, they had one strike against them before they even began because they violated the whole premise of what it takes to create teamwork. And that is the belief that if you ask people how they think the change should take place, those people will be more committed to it. Number three, involve the people who will be affected by the change in the process. And you can do that by asking a simple question. After explaining the change that needs to take place, ask the question, how will we do it? Number four, sell the benefits of the change. One of the key skills of high-impact leadership is persuasive communication. That means selling people on the vision. I think we don't spend enough time showing people how the change is either necessary to survive in the marketplace or how that change will translate into very real benefits for them and the organization. And finally, last but certainly not least, the cornerstone of any good program of improving performance. Reward those people who change, and reward those people who change quickly. As we know, according to Dr. Michael LaBeouf, the greatest management principle in the world is that what gets rewarded gets done. Therefore, we need to reward the change agents. The second value that you can harness organizationally to motivate your people is the fact that they value change, and that by using some simple skills and steps, you can overcome the natural resistance caused by laziness and the fear of the process of change. Here's the third value. Americans value time and its control. As a matter of fact, today many Americans value time even more than money. After all, you can enjoy time without money, but you cannot enjoy money without time. In America, I believe there is a time famine. As our standard of living increases, as our ability to earn more money increases, the time we have left to enjoy the money we earn diminishes. Let me give you some ideas on what you can do to harness the value that people place on time and its control. First, consider flexible hours. You see, in the old days of American business management, we were most concerned about when the work was done. Today, our concern should be with how well it's done. Different people with different metabolic rates perform better at different times of the day. And if you can structure an environment where people can work when they are at their peak levels of performance and their best mental alertness, that will benefit the quality that is being produced. The next idea is to use time as a reward. I've often thought it would be great to work at an organization where if you got your work done by 3 o'clock, you had a choice. You could go home early, or you could be rewarded with additional time by staying later that day, time that could be added, for instance, to a long weekend or to a vacation plan. Time is an excellent non-monetary reward because people value it. And finally, number three, eliminate time wasters for the people that you lead. High-impact leaders frequently ask the question, how do I personally or how do we organizationally waste our employees' time? If you want to find out, ask the employees that you lead and they will be glad to tell you. The fourth value that Americans consider to be very important is equality. As a matter of fact, equality has a religious bias. It is the belief that people are created equal. I've often thought in reality, people are created with equal value, but certainly they are not created into equal circumstances. Because as we all know, many people have to overcome serious handicaps and disadvantages imposed by the environment that they were born into. The key then for leadership is to give people equal opportunity in the workplace. The key for leadership is to make sure that people are treated fairly. Here are some things you can do. First, begin by removing policies and facilities that suggest to your employees that they live in a caste system. Ross Perot was the founder of Electronic Data Systems. Back when he was actively involved in the management of his organization, before he sold his company to General Motors, he found out that they had on the premises an executive dining room. He was angered. He ordered that the executive dining room be filled with mainframe computers and turned into computer space because he refused to suggest to employees that there was a caste system and that those people in leadership had special privileges that other employees did not. Rod Canyon is the founder and president of Compaq Computer, a $2.9 billion a year company, and yet Rod Canyon flies coach. Second idea is that if you are going to use perks to reward and motivate people, move from using perks with the attitude that rank has its privilege to using perks with the belief that performance has its privilege. You see, if you give all employees equal opportunities, you can then reward people on the basis of performance by giving them perks that other people don't enjoy because they have not performed at the same level. Equality, being treated fairly, being given equal opportunity is valued by the typical American employee. Number five is individualism and privacy. Americans believe they are individualistic and resist being thought of as typical. Now, even though we all share similar likes and dislikes, some of us have common interests, no one likes to think that they are typical. They believe that they are unique. Two ideas to keep in mind. First of all, beware of making people conform to the system. Now, we talked about that a little bit earlier, but it's important to remember that the system, as much as possible, should support and leverage the skills of people, not the other way around. Secondly, allow people to stand out while standing in. That means make sure that people feel a part of a team, but they still fulfill that need for personal recognition for their accomplishments. One of the significant differences between American and Japanese culture is that in the United States, we believe the squeaky wheel gets the grease, that people who either make enough noise or who perform well enough deserve special attention. In Japan, the saying is, the nail that sticks out gets pounded down. You see, one of the things that have made them successful that would not make us successful in this culture is a belief that everyone should conform and be uniform in their approach to life. In the United States, we need to capitalize on the strong belief and value people place on individualism. The sixth value you can use is self-help. People like to get credit for what they've accomplished. There are over 100 words in the English language dictionary that begin with the prefix self, as in the self-made man or the self-made woman. You see, that's still the ideal. Simple idea here, make self-help instruction available to the people that you lead. The first idea is to use a corporate resource center where books, magazines, video, and audio cassette tapes are available to any employees that care to check them out and use them at home. Interactive software is the next phase of employee education. Very popular in Europe today, it has yet to catch on with the same degree here as it has there. Make sure that employees get a chance to regularly attend seminars, even non-job related courses. You see, as I have alluded to, if you only do things like people in your industry do things, you will never be innovative. Therefore, if employees only attend job-related seminars, they'll never get the new ideas that stimulate their thinking about how to bring in ideas from other industries and other ways of doing business. And finally, create employee study groups for those people that are interested in meeting perhaps one day a week at breakfast so that they can talk about the tapes they've listened to, the videos that they've viewed, or the books that they've read. The seventh value is competition and free enterprise. Americans believe that competition brings out the best in any individual. Of course, this is problematic because what we find is that Americans, with their tendency towards excess, have come to believe that competition is the only way to bring out the best in individuals. Important finding. After reviewing 122 studies, the University of Minnesota researchers have concluded that cooperation within, coupled with competition without, was the ideal combination for maximum productivity. In other words, competition has its limits. Competition should stop at the front door of the building where you work. What I suggest is that you harness competition's power by directing the people that you lead to compete outward, not inward. No team ever gets ahead by competing against itself. However, you can focus the power of competition by getting the people that you lead to compete against one or more of these three things. First, get them to compete against a problem that needs to be solved. Get them working together to solve a common problem that threatens the group or the organization. Secondly, get them to compete against a goal that can be accomplished. People like to work together, especially when it's the accomplishment of a goal that they could not achieve individually. Finally, the third thing that you can use to direct people's competition outward is a competitor in the marketplace. Find a competitor that threatens to take market share or to take funding or that threatens the long-term viability of your organization and get people to compete outward. Now, I said, of course, that the value is competition and free enterprise. Let me just add in that we should treat employees like owners as much as possible by creating systems like profit sharing or stock ownership where people have not just a psychological but a literal investment in the organization where they work. The eighth American value that you can use is what's known as future orientation. That means highly valuing what the future holds in store, believing that no matter how good things are now, they could always be better. Now, the first suggestion I might make is make sure that future orientation doesn't work against you. Continually remind people of their present accomplishments and the present benefits that they're already enjoying. But once you've made sure that people have not taken the good for granted, you can move to step two. And that's to remember a song by Fleetwood Mac called Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. As a matter of fact, the whole basis for visioning is looking at the current view of situation known as CVS and comparing it to the better view of situation, which is BVS. BVS is an answer to the question, how could things be? How could we improve on our current view of the situation? And then secondly, it's strategizing what it will take to move from the current view of situation to better view of situation. Use future orientation to motivate people. Number nine is an action work orientation. We hear people say it all the time, you know, don't just stand there, do something. They take a no-nonsense attitude towards planning and organizing. What can you do to take advantage of this action orientation? First, if you're a leader, remember that just as a teacher prepares a lesson plan, you need to prepare individual and group agendas for each work week. Make sure that people have short-term goals that they can accomplish each day and each week, similar to the quick wins that I mentioned earlier. Secondly, if you want to make sure you don't demoralize people, keep your meetings short. Even though team meetings and staff meetings are important for disseminating information and giving people new ideas, one of the biggest drains on corporate America's energy is excessively long meetings that accomplish little. And finally, remember, planning an organization is important. It has its role. But planning an organization become procrastination when they replace timely action. Finally, the last value you can harness is that Americans value directness, openness, and honesty. Americans consider anything other than the most direct and open approach to be something short of honest and sincere. This possibly may be the single quickest way to improve not only the results that you produce with your followers, but the relationships that you enjoy with them as well. The suggestion is simply this: ask for what you need. You know, most of us grew up as children believing that adults were mind readers. We probably heard our parents go through a dialogue that went something like this: if you loved me, you would have known. I wouldn't have needed to tell you. And even today as adults, as we interact with spouses, with children, with coworkers and bosses, we find that for the last 3 months we've been doing something to drive them crazy, to irritate them, and when we ask them why they didn't tell us, the response was, you should have known, suggesting that we should have been clairvoyant. We should have known without them actually verbally expressing it. Here's a radical idea. If you're not getting what you need from another person in a relationship, ask for it. Now, occasionally people will say to me, well, I could never do that. Guess what? It's a no-lose scenario. If you're not getting what you need from another person in a relationship and you ask for it, the worst case scenario is you won't get it. But guess what? You're not getting it anyhow. You'll just keep on not getting it. The only difference is now you'll know they are malicious in not giving you what it is that you need to make the relationship work. Ask for what you need and be specific about what you need. Unclear requests produce unclear results. Find out what it is that the people you lead value and try to bring those values that they possess into alignment with your organizational values by understanding what's important to people and using some of these techniques and ideas to make sure that they get what's important. Perhaps the biggest challenge that any employee faces is how they move from non-leadership into leadership. For that reason, I'd like to give you 13 specific things you can do to become a leader, even though you may currently not have the title or position of leadership. According to the American Society for Training and Development, it is a buyer's market for managerial talent. By the mid-1990s, there will be 33 qualified candidates for every new middle management job that becomes available. That means we've got to find some ways to stand out in a positive manner, to exert leadership even while a non-leader. Here are the 13 ideas. Number one, analyze your manager's balance sheet. In other words, assess your boss's strengths and weaknesses. Once you know what your boss is best at, what they're most competent at, you can learn from those strengths. But the real opportunity comes from identifying your boss's weaknesses that represent complementary skills and strengths that you possess. You see, if your boss isn't particularly good at the written word, and that's one of your skills, you can offer to assist them in that area. Not only will they become better as a result of your help, but you'll have an opportunity to show what some of your potential leadership skills are. The key is finding a weakness that your boss has that also represents a complementary skill that you possess, and then making sure that you offer to assist. Number two, employ the stretch factor. Now, this particular technique is for you. Take on slightly more than the other people in your department. Now, you might ask the question, how could that possibly benefit me? First of all, it will force you to be better organized. One of the key attributes of leadership is that leaders typically have more to do than most human beings could possibly get done. So to learn how to lead, you need to take on slightly more than others so that you will be developing that skill of being better organized and preparing. Secondly, it'll keep you from growing bored. I think probably a greater reason for burnout in the workplace than overwork is being underworked. The only thing worse than having too much to do is being bored by not having enough to keep you constructively busy. And finally, the third way that this stretch factor, taking on slightly more than others, will benefit you is that it will prove to those people who are watching you your willingness to work hard. Recently, I was speaking at a university in the Midwest, and I was asked by some of the students how I could rectify and reconcile all my views on what it takes to be a high-impact leader with a course that they had just attended on creating life balance. And the point that I made to them is a very important point to remember today. We live in an imperfect world, and long-term life balance almost always requires short-term imbalance. In other words, there will be a period in your career of several months, several years, or longer where you will probably be imbalanced in terms of the amount of time you invest in what you do and the discretionary time that you have to enjoy outside of work. But my observation is the people who are willing to endure that short-term imbalance are those people who later live a much richer, fuller, and balanced life in the long run. Number three, if you want to become a leader, provide lagniappe on the job. Now, lagniappe is a French Cajun word that literally means just a little bit more. Back when the local grocer had most of their items in bulk commodity, if you ask for a pound of cereal, they would put a pound of cereal on the scales, and then they would dip their scoop back in and just add a little bit more to the scale. And that was proof that they valued your business. What we have to do is find ways to exceed what is expected of us in the workplace. The first thing is to realize that we cannot exceed expectations if we haven't sat down with our boss and clarified exactly what is expected. The next step is strategy, looking for creative ways that you can exceed those expectations your employer has of you. I recently met a man who is a computer repair person at the University of Minnesota. He said one Monday morning, he was fixing a computer that was broken. As he was fixing it, he remembered something that his father used to say. His father used to say, a clean car runs better on Saturday night. Now, of course, that's not actually true, but it is perceptually true. That is to say, if your car is clean, you feel better about it. It seems to run better. He thought, well, maybe if a clean car runs better on Saturday night, maybe a clean computer works better on Monday morning. So when he got done repairing the computer, which was exactly what was expected of him, he took another 2 or 3 minutes, he cleaned the computer inside and out. Then he left a note that said, while I was here to repair your computer, I also cleaned it for you. Shortly thereafter, he got the first thank you note of his career from one of his internal customers. He started cleaning computers as a matter of course. Whenever he was called in to repair them, he would do just a little bit more, practice lagniappe. It took him 2 or 3 minutes to clean the computer, but people sent him notes, sent memos to his boss, called his boss, and complimented him on the fine job that he was doing. A good example of why it's important to find out what is expected and then look for creative ways to exceed those expectations. Number three is to provide lagniappe on the job. Number four, suggest and implement improvements. Now, I believe there are two kinds of improvements in the workplace. The first are significant improvements that would require permission from your boss or someone higher up. Those improvements you can at least suggest. Now, it helps when you suggest an improvement that you present some data that proves the improvement is needed, as well as how you would suggest going about implementing the improvement. You see, making a suggestion is not nearly as difficult as proving the suggestion is worthwhile and coming up with ways to implement it. I said there were two types of improvements. The second type does not require any approval or permission from higher up. To borrow from a well-known advertising campaign, that type of improvement requires that you just do it. Number four, suggest and implement improvements. Number five, If you want to become a leader as a non-leader, become a problem solver. Now, spotting problems is not a highly developed skill. It's called moaning, groaning, and complaining. But you see, employers very much value those people who can not only identify problems, but come up with ways to solve them. Move from being a problem spotter into being a problem solver. Number six, lead a special project, either one that you create or one that you volunteer to lead. Now, you can actually combine this with my last idea. Find a significant problem that no single individual can solve organizationally and put together a task force to attack and solve the problem. But if you can, find an existing project and offer to lead or create a special project that will either solve a problem or create new value for the employer. Number seven, volunteer to research and report on what you find at a meeting. Now, there are actually four steps involved in making a high-impact leadership report at a meeting. The first is gathering data. Most problems that are presented in meetings are seldom quantified. For instance, we talk about wasting too much time, but what really is too much time? No one's ever taken time to quantify how much time is being wasted, how much time is normal, how much is abnormal. So begin by gathering data that will help you quantify the problem. My next step would be to interview other people about why they feel the problem is occurring or how they might suggest solving it. From those interviews, number three, come up with a list of suggestions. Take the best suggestions that you or others have been able to generate, and then end your report, number four, with recommended actions. You can add value to the meetings that you attend if you've taken time to research and report on what you found. Number eight, use the company grapevine to make wine. All organizations have an organizational grapevine that is fed usually with bad news stories. I'd suggest if you want to become a high-impact leader, you spread good news stories in the grapevine about the good things that are happening in your department or the good things that you've observed other people doing. Make sure that you withhold any self-serving comments. You see, the difference between gossip and useful information is all in motive. Gossip is self-serving. It is given not to benefit the group, but to benefit the giver. Useful information always builds relationships up, gives people information that they can use. So make sure that you're putting good wine grapes into the company grapevine. Number nine, talk your way to the top. Improve your presentation and speaking skills. Earlier in this tape series, I talked about IPE, an ongoing program of personal and professional development that includes ideas, people, and experiences. One of the best experiences that you could use to develop high-impact leadership would be to attend an intensive speaking course where you actually spend time speaking in front of an audience, and if possible, video feedback is used to improve your performance. I usually recommend to people who ask me how to become a good speaker that they join Toastmasters. Almost any town of any size in the United States today has several Toastmasters groups that meet weekly. It is a programmed system of developing speaking skills that I'd highly recommend to someone that wants to talk their way to the top. And finally, don't neglect the value of a one-day seminar. Although you may not get a lot of experience actually presenting in the one-day seminar, you'll gain a lot of useful knowledge and information that you can practice later. Number 10, master the small gesture. Our current president of the United States, President George Bush, was once President Nixon's ambassador to the United Nations. His first day on the job, George Bush shook every employee's hand at the 12-story U.S. mission in New York. Says current White House Chief of Staff John Sununu, George Bush is a master of the small gesture. George Bush knows that despite his power, his prestige, and status, it's the little things that count and matter to people. That's why I'd suggest if you want to be a master of the small gesture, you become a student of human psychology. You see, most people's education ends after high school or college. They don't continue to read the books that'll help them understand what's important to people and how to motivate them. They don't take time to observe those leaders who have the existing people skills that they can learn from. And they take even less time to actually apply the information that they've read or they've observed. Master the small gesture, an important part of success with people. Number 11, take a macro view of the world. Learn about other areas in your organization. Very often we know quite a bit about what we do and what our department does, but we never take time to understand how we interact with other departments, what they do. I'd suggest that you take someone new to lunch, someone outside your department, to find out more about what they do, how their area functions. Make sure you ask to be job-traded or cross-trained so that you become more flexible within your organization. But take a macro view of the world. Learn about other areas. Number 12, toot your own horn. 83% of an employee's good work never makes it to the boss's attention. I think one of the reasons that that happens is that people think it's improper to brag. But I always like to remind clients that if you've done it, it ain't bragging. What I'd suggest you do from time to time is make a one-paragraph summary of what you think have been significant contributions that you have made over the last several weeks. When it comes time for your performance evaluation every 6 or 12 months, take the 6 or 8 or 10 of those best paragraphs and combine that into a 2 to 3 page document that you can use as evidence that you're adding value to the organization. Make sure that the things that you have done that may have escaped your boss's attention are given the proper attention and that you get the credit you deserve. And finally, number 13, last but not least, in a country that seems to place more emphasis on style than substance, once you have developed the substance of leadership, look like a leader. When I was in high school, I ended up in traffic court and ended up getting a lecture from the judge about my driving. But he decided that for some odd reason, he would try to motivate me and help me get ahead in life. And he told me a story that I'll never forget. He told me about an intern who was working at a hospital on his way to becoming a medical doctor. He wanted to stand out from the other interns who were of about the same technical competency. They had all graduated from good medical schools. In an effort to stand out, he had the white hospital smock that he had been given tailored so that it fit him better. You see, he understood that the key to appearance was not to impress people, but to influence people. You see, impressing people is a head game. It's about how they think about you. However, what's more important in high-impact leadership is how they behave as a result of your influence on them. Even though substance is more important than style, people gather a great deal of information about your competency and your professionalism from the way that you appear. That's why I include it as last, but certainly it's not unimportant. Number 13, look like a leader. The amount of the information in the world will double in the next 1.7 years. One of the most difficult tasks of high-impact leadership is sorting through all of that data and gathering what is useful, important information that you can use to produce results. Let me give you three ideas for managing the information age. The first is to keep up on your reading each month. Create your own magazine. Some business leaders I know subscribe to as many as 20 or 25 different magazines. What they will do is they will have their assistant copy the table of contents for each of those magazines that they subscribe to, and they will then highlight those articles that are of interest to them. Those articles are then duplicated and bound into a report that effectively becomes a magazine created specifically for the reader. The other magazines are not defaced. They can be kept on file for later usage. Sometimes what I'll do, rather than having the articles copied, is I'll simply rip the pages out of the magazine and staple them together. Even though I don't have the magazines to use later, I find that information loses its value very quickly as it ages anyhow. So create your own magazine. Customize your own reading program each month. Next, get others to screen information for you. Now, that doesn't mean that you ask them to read your material. It simply says you let them know about articles that are of interest to you and topics that you want to learn more about. And if they find an article or a book that they think would appeal to you, that they simply pass that information on to you. I have several people who are screening information for me simply because they know there are several topics like leadership and service and team building that are important to me. And they suggest the articles and the books from the mass of information that they read that I might be interested in. And finally, number 3, you can use an acronym I've created to bring order to your information life. I call it the TASK system, T-A-S-K. You see, whenever a piece of information crosses your desk, you have 4 options about what to do with it. The T in TASK stands for the first thing that you should consider doing, and that is tossing it. Don't handle unnecessary information. As a case in point, I typically throw away 1 to 2/3 of my mail on the day that I receive it. I simply don't need to open some of the announcements and some of the flyers that have been sent to me. So the first question to ask yourself is, do I need to handle this at all? If not, the T in TASK stands for toss it. The A in TASK stands for that information that has not been tossed. Your next option is to act on it. Now, there are only 3 ways to act on printed information. The first is to write a letter of response. The second is to make a phone call, which is even more timely. Or the third is to defer action by scheduling what it is you will do at a later date. You see, acting simply says information is going to fall into one of three categories. Either you immediately write a letter, make a phone call, or you simply add that required course of action to your to-do sheet. Now, if you cannot toss the information, and if it doesn't seem appropriate to act on it, consider the third option, because the S in task stands for send it. If you know this information can be utilized by someone else in your organization, route it on to them. You do not need to create a memo. You simply put a post-it at the top upper right-hand corner with the letters FYI in the person's name. And finally, if you can't toss, act, or send, the K in task stands for keep it. This, of course, is filing for future reference. I suggest that most business leaders probably need no more than 10 to 15 topic files. Now, I'm not referring to client files or information that we need to maintain for legal purposes, but in terms of information that you can use in managing better and in understanding your business and industry, narrow your selection to about 10 to 15 topics and make sure that the information that you do save goes into one of those topic files. Create your own magazine, get other people to help screen information for you, and then utilize the task system, which gives you the only four options for dealing with any piece of information in your life, and that is to either toss it, act on it, send it, or keep it. As a high-impact leader, you undoubtedly ask yourself from time to time, if it is my job to motivate the people who follow me? Who motivates the motivator? I'd like to give you five philosophies for staying motivated in your life, both personally and professionally. Simple concepts, certainly nothing new here, no new truth. But five things that I've found we need to remind ourselves of on a regular basis if we are going to stay motivated. The first is this. Remember that you're a human being, not a human having. We tend to focus a lot of our lives on what we possess, on the material wealth that we enjoy, and yet the quality of our lives is determined primarily internally rather than externally. Janet Hagberg wrote a book in 1984 called Real Power, Stages of Personal Power and Organization. And she talked about six stages of development in both power and maturity. Stage one was powerlessness. That meant lacking no personal power, lacking the maturity of adulthood. Stage two was power by association, which meant learning the ropes and getting ahead by associating with and benefiting from the groups that you are a part of who have power. Stage three was power by symbols. This is the material stage where we evaluate the quality of our lives by our external success. Things like degrees, positions, salaries, and possessions. And of course, the great irony is that many people mistakenly believe the fullest human attainment is at stage three, power by symbols. Stage four, however, is power by reflection. That comes from thinking, questioning, and reassessing your life. It comes from transcending what you possess and focusing on what you are and what you want to become. Stage five, which then naturally follows, is the power of purpose. And I said that purpose is a key motivator to the high-impact leader, knowing why they do what it is they do each day. And finally, according to Janet Hagberg, step six is power by gestalt, what she called guru status. And it's a little bit vague, but it just seems that some people attain such mastery and peace in their life that they naturally attract others who want to learn from them. According to Drs. Robert Ornstein and medical doctor David Sobel, in a book called Healthy Pleasures, the amount of education seems to correlate with improved health and resistance to disease, even more powerfully than some of the highly publicized risk factors like high cholesterol, smoking, high blood pressure, or obesity. In other words, there is some evidence that suggests that by focusing on what you feed your mind, on the kind of person you are and become, that you can live a fuller and healthier life than by simply focusing on what you do or what you have. Ray Bradbury once said, "If we could only remember, fame and money are gifts given us only after we have gifted the world with our best, our lonely, our individual truths." Begin by remembering you're a human being, not a human having. Here's my second suggestion if you want to stay motivated. Even Einstein played with his dog. Enjoy the little pleasures in life. Actively seek out the little things that make a difference to you. While I was in Hong Kong, I visited the Sung Dynasty village in Kowloon. There was the replica of what was known as the rich man's house, typical of an affluent person in China during the Sung Dynasty. At the entry of the house, they kept what was known as a wealth bowl. It was full of gold and gems and precious items. And the purpose was first to show off what they had attained, but secondly, they believed that by exhibiting their wealth, it would bring more wealth. I think that you and I need to create wealth bowls in our life. And these wealth bowls are not bowls full of our possessions, but bowls full of memories that we can glean from journals that we've kept, things that we've written about, from photos that we've taken, and awards that we've received. You see, we very quickly tend to put those important pleasures behind us in life as we move on, feeling that we need to be intensely focused on what we do and that it's a waste of time to focus on what we've accomplished. But my point is that even Einstein, one of the brightest minds that ever lived, took time to enjoy the little pleasures. Number three, stay close to the people who really matter. I think we're confused because we believe that we can have many, many friends in this life. Psychologists believe you can only have about 10 to 12 close people in your life that might be termed friends. I believe it's probably more accurately somewhere between 3 to 5. You see, many of us have acquaintances in our lives, people we know and appreciate and enjoy from time to time when we see them, but we never really focus on the people that matter to us until it's too late or we realize that we've lost that friendship. I think if you, as a high-impact leader, spend a great deal of time away from friends and family, or if you travel, you have come over time to realize that there can be a very high price to being a leader if you get away from the people who really matter. Number three, stay close to those people. Number four, be a good animal. Stay healthy. Recently, I had a chance to view the F40 Ferrari. With a retail list price of $399,000, it is currently selling in the open market for nearly $1 million. Considered to be one of the most exotic pieces of machinery on the planet. As I watched the people viewing the F40, I realized that they were approaching this automobile with a certain kind of reverence and awe. I can guarantee you that the people who own F40 Ferraris are very attentive to the gas that they put into the automobile and to the maintenance that they lavish on it. If you remember, there was a TV series, probably reruns are still playing somewhere in the world, called The Bionic Man, The $6 Million Man. The idea being that the bionics of this particular human being were worth at least $6 million. Of course, we now know that scientifically, the human body could not be replicated for anything close to $6 million. We have bodies and minds that are infinitely more valuable than an F40 Ferrari, and yet we treat ourselves like a low-performance vehicle. We do not lavish the same amount of attention, the same amount of care. We do not pay attention to the foods we put into our body. Now, what I'm talking about is not a fanatical attention to health or a paranoia about disease. What I am talking about, however, is making sure that in your life you schedule time for three things. You see, in my own career, I've gone through three phases. For the first 3 to 4 years in my career as a speaker, I worked almost nonstop, typical workaholic, very little time to play. As my business began to grow, I started scheduling playtime. I worked hard, but I played hard, and I prided myself on that. Only recently have I come to realize that the third and perhaps the most important ingredient is to schedule time to rest. Play and rest are not the same thing. You can work hard and play hard, become exhausted, and have less to give to the people that you live and work with. I think if you're going to be a good animal and stay healthy, you need to schedule time not only for work and not only for play, but some time for reflection, for meditation, and rest. Because as someone once said, solitude is the price we pay for wisdom. And finally, number five, I am a big believer that we should make adventure a regular part of our lives. Helen Keller once said, life is either an exciting adventure or nothing at all. You know, we fall into complacency. We do the same things, work at the same jobs, go home to the same home day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. On a regular basis, make it a point to shake your own cage. Do something that moves you outside of your comfort zone. Do something that challenges you, maybe even scares you just a little bit. While I was in Australia speaking, I scheduled several days at the end of my speaking tour to do some diving on the Barrier Reef. Spent 3 days diving in some of the most incredible diving waters in the world. I had one day before I was to fly back to the United States, and I ran across an unusual opportunity. I decided to make a bungee cord jump off a 150-foot bridge. Now, I had made this decision by consulting with people who did it. I consulted with the people who ran the bungee jump operation. They had made over 40,000 jumps without serious injury or death. I even spoke to a medical physician who assured me that bungee cord jumping was safe. And I had intellectually decided to make the jump. I had committed to that decision. The day that I arrived at the jump site, they had specially constructed a bridge just for the purpose of jumping 150 feet over a small pond of water. And as I started to climb the stairs to the top of that bridge, I made an interesting discovery. And that is, intellectual commitment diminishes proportionate to height. The higher I climbed, the more I began to question my judgment, my common sense. When I made it to the top of the bridge, a certain amount of pure, unadulterated terror set in. You see, the pond below looked like a mud puddle. The people below looked like ants. Cairns, Australia, which was 22 miles off in the distance, looked much closer. And as I stood at the top of the bridge, I remembered reading about a primitive part of the brain that takes over when we're afraid, a primitive part of the brain that we don't typically tap into in our daily lives. And I remember thinking that if I were going to jump, I would have to depend on that primitive part of the brain, because my logical, rational brain was telling me not to do it. As a matter of fact, I told the people, I said, get me tied up quick so that I can get this jump over with, because I realized that I was very close to reneging on that intellectual decision to jump. Well, they wrapped a nylon climbing cord around my ankles several times, tied it on the end of the bungee cord, had me stand on at the edge of the bridge, looking down 150 feet. I realized that everything I had learned as a child, not to stand too close to the edge of things, made perfect sense. I was very upset. I was very nervous. I was a bit distressed. This was being videotaped, so we have record of my distress. The bungee cord operators explained it like this. They said, we're going to count backwards from five. When we get to one, we want you to leap out towards the ocean. Now, I had gotten some good advice from some other people who had bungee jumped. They suggested possibly jumping when they got to three or to two so that you didn't chicken out when they got to one. In other words, at any time between five and one, it would be a good idea to jump and get off the bridge and get it over with. Well, I waited until they got down to one. Five, four, three, two, one. Using that primitive part of my brain, having shut off all logic and ration, I leapt out and I made an incredible discovery. Jumping is not at all scary. The only scary part is thinking about jumping. You see, once I jumped, once I'd made that commitment, it was the closest thing to flying I'd ever experienced. I went down 150 feet. When I got to the bottom, the bungee cord took me back up almost 125 feet. For a certain period of time, there was weightlessness, and I yo-yoed three or four times before I finally settled at the end of the cord. They lowered me down to the raft. They untied me. That was the end of my bungee jump. It reminded me of a couple of things. First, it reminded me that most of the things we fear in our lives are not nearly as scary when we finally confront them and do them as they are when we think about them. I think one of the key differences between a manager and a high-impact leader is that managers rationalize and they intellectualize. I have now become convinced that one of the keys of high-impact leadership is that once we have made an intellectual decision to rely on the primitive part of the brain that compels us to move forward with no more thought, discussion, intellectualization, or rationalization. But there's another lesson that I learned from bungee cord jumping. The woman that jumped after me had a more difficult time getting off the bridge. They counted backwards from 5, 8, or 10 times. It took 8 or 9 minutes to get her to jump. And when she finally jumped, she didn't jump so much as she basically fell. But when they finally had lowered her down to the raft, brought her into shore, I said to her, I said, you know, while they were trying to get you to jump, you obviously were afraid and unwilling. What was it that finally made you jump off the bridge? Never forget what she said. She said, they only asked me two questions. They said, number one, how will you feel after you've jumped? And number two, how will you feel if you don't? Next time you find yourself facing an important decision and you're not sure what to do, ask two simple questions. Not how do you feel right then as you face the fear, as you confront the challenge, but ask a simple question. When you've successfully confronted the challenge, how will you feel? And if you decide not to take that challenge on months and years later, how will you feel if you haven't made that leap? High-impact leadership is about keeping your own cup full so that you have more to share with the people that you live and work with. Who motivates the motivator? The answer is the motivator. By focusing on who they are and what they're becoming rather than what they own or possess. By taking time to enjoy the little pleasures in their life, not just the significant life events. Those motivators who stay motivated stay close to the people who really matter to them. They treat themselves like a high-performance vehicle. They're good animals. They stay healthy. But finally, they never become complacent. They continually shake their own cage and make adventure a regular part of their life. And that's what it takes to motivate the motivator. Several years ago, I was speaking at a convention in Hawaii. I flew in a few days early so that I could visit some of the outlying islands outside of Honolulu, the island of Oahu. One of the islands I visited was the Big Island of Hawaii. And we flew into the airport at Kona. The airport there considered to be one of the most beautiful in the world. We boarded tourist buses that were to take us into the old fishing village, which had been converted into a modern-day resort. And as we drove into the fishing village, I noticed that volcanic activity in years gone by had left molten and now solidified volcanic ash all around us. It looked like a giant plowman had turned over these volcanic ash fields. Black volcanic ash as far as the eye could see. And yet alongside each side of the road, carefully placed in the black volcanic ash, were small white stones, spelling out the names of the people who had traveled that way, the people who had visited before. Bob and Sally, honeymoon 1977. John, 1979. And what it reminded me of is what happens every year when graduating seniors assault bridges and water towers in the mainland United States. You see, it seems that we all have a genetic need to leave our mark in life, to let people know that we have passed that way, that we've been here. In the world we live in today, we're surrounded by horses galloping wildly out of control. High-impact leadership challenges some of us to pick up the reins, to take control of what happens in our lives and in our organizations, for that matter, in our communities and our world. You see, the high-impact leader knows that as life goes on and we reflect the things we've said and done, the places we've been, the people we've met, and we think of all the fun, we realize the marks we leave in life aren't made of stone or steel, but rather the lives we've touched and how we make people feel. For people are far more valuable than achievements great and high, than cars or planes or space shuttles or buildings reaching to the sky. You and I can leave our mark in life by doing all we can to serve and praise and uplift the lives of our fellow man. And that is high impact leadership. Thank you.
This completes our featured program, High Impact Leadership with Mark Sanborn. As an added bonus, we're including a brief excerpt from a closely related career track program, High Output Management, by Dr. Andrew S. Grove, author of the book, High Output Management, and president and CEO of Intel Corporation, a multi-billion dollar giant. If you're challenged by your career as a manager, and you've set your personal goals high, this program is for you. It's designed for managers like you in organizations of all types. You won't hear any lofty, high-level management theories, but instead, you'll hear answers to practical issues you face every day. The author, Andy Grove, is no stranger to effective management techniques. Instrumental in major breakthroughs in the technology of semiconductors, he participated in the founding of Intel Corporation. He also writes a weekly syndicated column providing career advice to questioning readers and is author of the acclaimed One-on-One with Andy Grove. We hope you enjoy this special bonus excerpt from Career Track's highly popular program, High Output Management with Andy Grove.
A great deal of a manager's work has to do with allocating resources. Manpower, money, and capital. But the single most important resource that we allocate from one day to the next is our own time. In principle, more money, more manpower, or more capital can always be made available, but our own time is the one absolutely finite resource we each have. Its allocation and use, therefore, deserve considerable attention. How you handle your own time is, in my view, the single most important aspect of being a role model and leader. In a typical day of mine, I can count some 25 separate activities in which I participated, mostly information gathering and information giving, but also decision making and nudging. Some 2/3 of my time was spent in a meeting of one kind or another. Before you are horrified by how much time I spend in meetings, answer a question. Which of the activities, information gathering, information giving, decision making, nudging, and being a role model, could I have performed outside a meeting? The answer is practically none. Meetings provide an occasion for managerial activities. Getting together with others is not, of course, an activity. It is a medium. You, as a manager, can do your work in a meeting, in a memo, or through a loudspeaker for that matter, but you must choose the most effective medium for what you want to accomplish. And that is the one that gives you the greatest leverage. Now, leverage was the concept I introduced earlier in discussing productivity. Meetings allow me to leverage my time. What else can I do to gain greater managerial leverage? First, let me define leverage more precisely. For every activity a manager performs, the output of the organization should increase by some degree. The extent to which that output is increased is determined by the leverage of that activity. Clearly, the key to high output is being sensitive to the leverage of what you do during the day. The output of managers per unit of time worked can be increased in three ways. First, by increasing the rate with which managers perform their activities, speeding up their work. Second, by increasing the leverage associated with the various managerial activities. And third, by shifting the mix of managers' activities from those with lower to those with higher leverage.
This completes our bonus excerpt from Career Track's High Output Management with Dr. Andrew S. Grove. In addition to the information-packed program you've just heard, Career Track offers a wide range of seminars and audio and video cassette tapes on a variety of topics in professional development, self-improvement, and business training. To order your copy of High Output Management or any Career Track product, simply pick up the phone and call toll-free 1-800-334-1018. And here's a final note to remember. Our famous one-year unconditional guarantee. If you are not 100% completely satisfied with any Career Track product for any reason, you have up to one full year to return it for an exchange or a full refund. That's how sure we are that you'll find Career Track materials to be a wise investment. Thank you for listening to High Impact Leadership with Mark Sanborn. And thank you for making Career Track your success company.